start today's BPR with politics with Michael Curry and Jennifer Braceras. A few days out, what's the impact of the Comey-Trump wars? And is a drop bond rating bad news for our state CEO-in-chief, Charlie Baker? Then it's Ground Truth, Charlie Sennett, as a fellow conservative calls Theresa May a dead woman walking. And what happens with Brexit? At noon, it's former Obama drug czar Michael Botticelli, now at Boston Medical Center, hell-bent on prevention and reducing the stigma of drug addiction.
Our TV man, Bob Thompson, on two noteworthy passings. Adam West, the original Batman, and the genius who gave us those wonderful claymations, Wallace and Gromit. We'll open the lines and ask you. The Brits don't like who's running the show. The Brits have snap elections. Do you wish we could have one here? Then we're all wrapped up with Iron Monroe and Emmett Price on liberal evangelicals taking on conservative evangelicals in hopes of reshaping America's moral agenda. He is Jim Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there. I can't believe you haven't said what I knew you were going to say, but didn't.
What?
It's a scorcher. Isn't that?
It is a scorcher. That's absolutely right. The wet sheets will be in full swing tonight.
We're not doing that segment today, but we will do it soon. So first he was a showboat, then he was a nut job, and now President Trump is tweeting that James Comey is, quote, very cowardly. Well, the president also has some choice words for his attorney general, Jeff Sessions. And by the way, speaking of Sessions, CNN is reporting Sessions is the one who's asking the session be public tomorrow after he testifies before the Senate intelligence community. Here with us in Studio 3 to take on this and other headlines. Michael Curry's stuck in traffic. He'll be here in a minute. Jennifer Braceras is already here. Michael is an attorney, the immediate past president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. He's currently the NAACP's national board of directors. Jennifer is a conservative political analyst. Jennifer, you have the field to yourself. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Hi, Jennifer. How
Hi.
Are you?
Can
we
well,
ask,
thank you.
Can we start with this for one second? Am I missing something? Right before we went on the air, I asked Marjorie, so do we know if Sessions tomorrow is public or private in front of the Senate, public or behind closed doors in the Senate Intelligence Committee? The headline, the breaking news, my least favorite term on CNN, even though it is breaking news, is Session asked for a public hearing tomorrow. Why in the world would the committee not immediately say yes? And if there's certain things that are inappropriate for public consumption, a la Comey the other day, then they go in a closed door session, huh?
You got me. I can't imagine why they would.
But that'd be fun, wouldn't it? I'd love to hear him talk. He's like a little leprechaun, I think.
That's great, Marjorie. That's really
he really does. You don't want to stand him up next to Jim Comey. It wouldn't go well.
No, that wouldn't be a pretty picture.
It wouldn't be a pretty picture. So speaking of the Comey hearings, Jennifer, Laura Ingraham, the conservative talk show host, said of the Comey hearings that Comey gave an early Christmas present to the GOP, and she and a lot of other conservatives were thinking, no problem, no big deal, independents and Democrats were like saying, you know, this is the beginning of the end. What do you think the impact of these hearings was?
I'm sort of in between. I mean, I agree with Laura that there's no there in terms of prosecutable offense. I do think it's politically disastrous for the president, which is what the Democrats want, right? So I think we have a situation here where even the Democratic members of Congress understand that what happened here is not a crime under the laws of the United States of America.
Some Democrats do, not all Democrats. Some Democrats think that the obstruction case has been made.
That's what they say.
Yeah, I'm not saying they're right or wrong. I'm just saying it's not all
Democrats. I don't even think they believe it. I think because it's so clearly not the case to me. I do think you can make an argument that there could be impeachable offenses because impeachment is a breach of the public trust. However,
and doesn't have to be a formal statutory crime.
Correct.
Right, yeah.
Correct. However, I don't think that's ever going to happen, and the Democrats know that's never going to happen because the last thing they want is for Mike Pence to become president, right? If you impeach the president, you don't get a do-over. You don't get Hillary Clinton. You get Mike Pence, and that's the last thing they want. So the reality is, I think what we're looking at, and I'm no fan of this president. I'm really not, but I think what we're looking at is a situation where the Democrats are trying to damage the presidency as much as possible, but nothing will come of it in terms of prosecution.
Well, you know, let's talk about that, because I've had that conversation a million times with people who are no fans of the president either. You know, they, on the one hand, people say, well, you know, I don't want Mike Pence because Mike Pence is an ideologue and he's very conservative and he would probably be
and
very
competent.
Successful yes. at getting things
and
through.
And normal.
Yes. On the other, but on the other, and they say, at least, you know, he's not going to, they don't think he's going to blow up the world. It's not going to be in like a nuclear war. I mean, that's an extreme situation, obviously. But some people are afraid of Trump in that regard, that he's so impulsive. But tell us about that, because he could get a lot of things through Congress that are now much quicker than we're seeing the president move, even though Congress does seem to be doing some things on their own.
I think Donald Trump is his own worst enemy, right? I mean, every time things seem to be under control, he goes out and tweets something that, you know, throws a monkey wrench into his plans, right? Be it his legal cases or his political objectives. I mean, he's his own worst enemy. Mike Pence is, you know, your average run-of-the-mill competent politician. Well, I don't know if every politician's competent. I should roll that back. But Mike Pence is more conservative than Donald Trump and therefore not exactly what the Democrats want to see.
You know, but one thing that I think I end up partially where you are, vis-a-vis, I'm in the middle to, if I can characterize what you said a couple of minutes ago, vis-a-vis these hearings. But then, as I said to Marjorie before the show, I rewatched some of this stuff this weekend. Mm-hmm. When you have the former head of the FBI, a guy who the Republican chair of the committee, Burr from North Carolina, at the end of the hearing, not only thanks for his service, but says, and I'm paraphrasing, I find you credible, no questioning of his credibility. Right. Twice call the president of the United States a liar. Yes, I don't know what that leads to. I mean, I know that's not
lying
connected to a
right.
prosecution. It's right. not connected to necessarily to an impeachment. But it is a dramatic moment in American right. history that this happened. And I have to say, I knew it intellectually, but emotionally, it really came to me over the weekend when I watched right. little excerpts of this testimony.
I have no doubt in my mind that Jim Comey is sincere in saying that the president made him feel incredibly uncomfortable and that he couldn't trust what he was saying. That's, you know, patently clear from his testimony and everything we know. But that's not a crime. That's not necessarily an impeachable offense. It just means this president is incredibly inappropriate. right? I mean, not just inappropriate, but he seems to be a complete amateur in understanding how Washington works and what boundaries are appropriate. And, you know, his demand for loyalty above all else is problematic, politically problematic, but it's not.
But, you know, one of the interesting things, we're talking to Jennifer Braceras. Michael Curry is going to join us in a couple of minutes. He's stuck in traffic. You know, almost every article I read about, so what propels this guy? That being the president of the United States, what almost every article says, well, his key, his driving force is solidifying the base. But the numbers suggest that even the base is disenchanted. When you look at the healthcare repeal numbers, when you look at what was the thing last week where we had 17% approval? Getting out of the Paris.
Climate
Accords, the most recent polling has them in the mid-30s. Marjorie pointed out to me one poll amongst 18 to 34-year-olds, future of the democracy, 19% approval.
To 67 disapproval.
Why is it that nobody there who understands politics, and maybe there isn't somebody, says, you know, it's really time to work on something that's going to bring right. somebody, a couple of independents in, maybe a Democrat or two, like a Joe Manchin, that kind of person.
Well,
why isn't that happening?
I think I disagree with your assumption that everything he does is designed to satisfy the base.
No, I didn't say it was my assumption. I said everything I read is that. Yeah, okay,
that.
You disagree with that.
I disagree with that because I don't think he has even that foresight. I think he's just, as you said, impulsive. He just acts and reacts. And I think his only goal is to advance Donald Trump at that moment in time in a way that he thinks is best, but I actually think hurts him. I think he's completely.
So you haven't warned him. This is a conservative political analyst, as those of you know who know Jennifer Braceras. We know you weren't crazy about Trump. On is there anything he's done in 135 days? I don't know what something like that that has caused you to warm to any piece of the Trump as president or no?
I don't have problems as with Trump's policies. I don't have problems with his legislative agenda. I have problems with Trump the man.
Yeah, which part? Stay there. Which part of Trump? What part of Trump the man?
I think, as you know, as we all know, he's thin-skinned. He's difficult to control. He's erratic. He's hot-tempered. I mean, all of the things we saw and know from the campaign that he's continued to be. I find it very distressing. I don't think he's a good role model for our nation's children. But more importantly, I think he's sabotaging the Republican agenda by his erratic behavior.
Speaking of role model, do you remember the great moment where Kelly Ayotte, then United States Senator and candidate for re-election, said
that
he was a role model for her kid in the debate, and then the next morning she realized he was not a role model for her kid, which may have ended up costing her the election. Michael Curry!
Hey.
Were you listening in the car, I hope?
I was trying to, but I was rushing.
Look at him.
He's behind an accident.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's a hot day.
Why don't you give your a 10-second summary of yourself, Jennifer Braceros, on how you think we came out of the Comey-Trump hearings and see if Michael shares your worldview there.
Well, I'm sure he doesn't share my worldview. That I can tell
sometimes.
You right now. No, my view is essentially that, you know, although the testimony is politically damaging for the president and his legislative agenda, that there's no evidence of any criminal wrongdoing. And, you know, we can discuss why it is I think that, and that it's very unlikely that anything that happens will lead to impeachment simply because Mike Pence is the best insurance policy that Donald Trump could have ever purchased.
So?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. People say that there's no evidence of wrongdoing. I think that the
criminal wrongdoing.
Really, we are in an investigation process. Mm-hmm. So people are already committing themselves to there's no proof. When in fact we're waiting on that. That's really what this is about, is having an investigation is not impacted or influenced by this administration as we've seen play out. And now they're talking now about even the potential of removing Bob Mueller from an investigation, the prosecutorial process. So to me, it just...
For those who don't know, a member of Trump's legal team said that he would not rule out the possibility that Donald Trump would do the same thing. Here's a little bit. This guy, let me just say, George Stephanopoulos asked this guy, his name is Sekulo, something like that, a member of his legal team, if the president would order the attorney general ever to fire Mueller. And here's what Sekulo, if that's how you say his name, said.
Right now, the role of the president is to govern the United States of America. He's going to do that. He's going to leave anything else to the lawyers. But I can't imagine that issue is going to arise. But that, again, is an issue that the president with his advisors would discuss if there was a basis. I mean, George, if there was a basis upon which there was a question raised that raised the kind of issues that are serious, as in the situation with James Comey, the president has authority to take action. Whether he would do it is ultimately a decision the president makes.
Now, we would agree if, just like James Comey, if Robert Mueller was unkind to Hillary Clinton, he should be fired, correct? That was a joke. Okay, well, but you say we're just in the middle of the investigation.
Yeah.
Donald Trump, and I'm paraphrasing the other day, said, well, I never said that thing about, can you see fit to get rid of the Flynn thing? But even if I did, everybody agrees there's no crime. Let's assume he did say it. And it seems to me that most members of the committee, including the Republicans, bought Comey's testimony. That's just my reaction to their body language and their statements.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One that was under oath, too.
What does that amount to?
Well, I think ultimately it shows that, one, and I think even the Republican Party acknowledges this, that Trump is not a truthful person. Trump will flip on his perspective. And quite frankly, I think it's the shadiness that we see in real estate that he's brought into governing. And the reality is, I don't think there's any disagreement that Trump did say, I hope you'll see fit to let this go. I don't think there's any disagreement that Trump will try to influence this and in every way he can, even if it's firing people, to make this go away.
He denies the loyalty thing, too, you know.
And his family sort of flips on this. His son recently said that he may have said this or did say mm-hmm. this. His daughter, you know, has his talking points. You never know what's coming from this family. It's like the Bad News Bears. You never know what's going on with the Trump family.
We really need to dial this back a second, because the president of the United States has the constitutional authority to terminate any investigation for any reason at any time in any place, right? So, for example, he has the legal authority to pardon Michael Flynn. He could have done that last week. He could do it today. So certainly he can do that.
And he has legal authority to fire Comey, and he has legal authority to fire Mueller.
Was about draining the swamp, and this is all swampish to me.
I'm not saying any of this is a good idea. I'm not saying any of this is appropriate. I'm simply saying there's enough to talk about without ratcheting up the rhetoric into the realm of crimes. right?
But well, you read the story.
You know what, though? What I wonder about is why is he so partial to the Russians? You know, that's the thing you keep saying. He just gave back those compounds that Obama took away over the election. I know we still have sanctions and stuff, but it's like he can't, you know, he fires Comey. The next day he's in there with, what's his name, Kislyak or whatever his name is, Lavrov and the two Russian guys, without the American press and with the Russian press. You wonder, what is up? That's the thing that makes you think there's something more going on here than just, I mean, there's something going on with him in Russia.
Where there's smoke, there's fire.
I don't think there's anything going on with him in Russia that we've seen so far. There's been bad judgment, perhaps.
Yeah, but we haven't seen his taxes, so we don't know.
Why does he care so much about, speaking of that, one of the questions has come, why does he care so much about Flynn? I mean, unless one assumes it's just because he's a really decent guy, Donald Trump, who cares about a guy he thinks is a good guy, why is there this borderline obsession with
Flynn? I think he just thinks, look, I fired him, I took care of it, and I'm in control here, and let's just move on. I also think... One thing that was clear from the Comey testimony is he does believe, and I think rightfully, that the investigation is casting a cloud over his presidency and impeding his legislative agenda. Not because there's anything there, but just because the press keeps, you know, ginning it up.
Can we talk about the Democrats for a second? You've said Jennifer Becerra on a couple of occasions. You've said a couple of times this morning, why does everything have to be ratcheted up to this kind of level, you know, impeachment crime? By the way, Sessions testify in
very
an
exciting
open hearing.
There goes my whole day tomorrow.
Can you find out what time that is, please, Tori? Thank you.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But, you know, there was an interesting piece, I thought, yesterday in the Boston Globe, Michael, from quoting Seth Moulton and Catherine Clark, two young progressive members of the Massachusetts delegation, basically saying, forget this impeachment stuff. If we expect to take over the House in 2018, I'm paraphrasing, our base may be saying, impeach this guy, but we know we've got to put forth a progressive agenda that recaptures the majority of Congress for the Democrats. Are they on the right track? Because they're going to encounter a lot of anger from people who think, I don't care that Mike Pence could be worse ideologically. We want this guy out.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I was listening to Bernie Sanders' comments even this week around the failure of the Democratic Party.
Right. Democrats lost. Trump didn't win.
And it's true. I mean, the reality is, I think the focus should be on the midterm election. Impeachment's too soon. I think people want to have the people who are very much anti-Trump, and there's some non-Democrats who are anti-Trump, some Republicans, see impeachment as a hopeful thing. But the reality is, let's wait on that. Let's wait to see if he was involved in something that was criminal and that whether we have to initiate an impeachment process. But we're not there yet. The reality is we got to focus on voters, getting out voters, getting people to the polls, and really turning the House. And I think that's where the focus is. And unfortunately, people get ahead of the conversation by talking about impeachment.
You know, one last thing before we switch to law. I don't understand how he can get away with this dance about tapes or no tapes. And I don't understand, and maybe one of you two crack lawyers can explain to me, why isn't Congress, these key committees, just subpoenaing the tapes and let his lawyer say, we don't have any, or we're going to turn them over? Here's a little bit of an exchange on that. This guy, David Boyer from the Washington Times, asked a question of Donald Trump, and listen to the first part of Trump's answer in particular.
I wondered if you could tell us in person, sir, why you feel that his testimony vindicated you when it's really boils down to his word against your word. And if you could also tell us, sir, do tapes exist of your conversations with him?
Well, I'll tell you about that maybe sometime in the very near future. But
you can end it there.
Meantime,
well, I'll
no
tell
collusion.
You about it. We can end there. Sometime in the first, you know, Congress, I have to say,
it's a game, Jim.
While I complimented
the
Senate Intelligence Committee for acting like grown-ups during the Comey hearing, Republicans and Democrats, for the most part, were grown up and not wildly partisan. On the other hand, I don't know why they didn't hold those intelligence officials in contempt the day before when they said, well, we have no legal basis for not answering. We just don't feel like telling you what we discussed with the President of the United States. Why is this issue about tapes still lying in the ether, Jennifer Becerra?
I don't know. They should ask for them.
They should and if
they exist.
And if they don't get it, they should subpoena them. Should they not?
Yeah.
Hello?
I agree.
Absolutely agree.
Can you imagine that?
Absolutely.
We agree.
Okay. Then we'll have 97,000 hours of listening to all the tapes since Trump came into office. That'll be wild, too. One last quick thing.
Can you imagine we got the tapes and we heard wrong,
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 sad, loser.
No.
I know. Just one last quick thing about the Democrats. So you mentioned Bernie Sanders. And obviously, there's a very fired up, very progressive Bernie Sanders part of the party.
Yeah.
And then there's the other part of the Democrats that voted for Donald Trump because they were sick of the Democrats. So how does that group coalesce? I mean, it can't just be Trump's a jerk. It has to be more than that, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be around issues. The reality is there's a lot of things the Democratic Party cares about and many independents care about and some Republicans who may move to the other side. But the messaging gets lost in all the gamesmanship, right? We just saw a Republican campaign that, quite frankly, the candidate won because he's a master at distraction.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, the Democratic Party has to redirect people back to the issues that they matter about. The attacks on health care, the attacks on the financial protections we put in place, all those things need to be the focus. And if we do lose, we lose those gains. And
look,
we lose those gains
of
the Obama administration.
With Michael Moore, really. There's nothing conservatives want more than a contest of ideas, right? Let's have a contest of ideas and leave Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi and everybody else out of it.
Okay, we're talking politics with Jennifer Becerris and Michael Carr. We're going to keep talking about local and state politics on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking national and now local politics with political analyst, conservative Jennifer Becerris, and attorney Michael Curry. He's on the NAACP's National Board of Directors.
Let's start with you, Jennifer Becerris. Charlie Baker's
ma'am.
A very, very popular governor, as everybody knows. But we've just been downgraded. Standard & Poor's has just lowered its rating for Massachusetts bonds. AA to AA plus means that you know, it'll be cost us more to borrow and stuff like that. That's a problem for the super manager, Charlie Baker, is it not?
It can be. I mean, the other ratings agencies kept us, I think, at the highest level. But it can be a problem. I think Baker is doing a good job of trying to spin it and explain it that we're better than where we were. We haven't met the mark yet. And under his administration, they have improved in terms of the rainy day fund.
Yeah, they've been raiding the rainy day fund. It's one of the reasons they lost.
And not replenishing it.
Not replenishing
it. You know,
he's appealing to the legislature to not keep spending.
Yeah.
And some of them are saying you got to raise taxes to do this too, which is going to be one of the debates in 2018 when he's running for re-election. Jay Gonzalez, one of the three Democrats who wants the nomination, says Baker is failing us because of this. My sense is the average person doesn't give a damn about bond rating. However, in a commercial come next year, when candidates try to explain what a falling bond rating means, at least to them, the Democratic, it could have an impact. Particularly, we had Brian McGorry on Wednesday, who editor of the Globe, who was saying, you know, paraphrasing, the one thing you have to give it to, the guy is a really good manager. If he weren't elected for that reason in great part, this wouldn't mean anything, but he was.
Yeah, I don't think people are paying attention to it. I think that the reality is anybody who's running against Charlie Baker is going to have to make a different argument, which is that we're not where we should be as a state. They're in lockstep in the sense that the Baker administration and the legislature have an issue to deal with. The deficit that we're facing, whether we're raiding the rainy day funds and relying on one-time assessments, non-taxes to shore up our budget. All that stuff needs to be worked out by the administration and the legislature. And the reality is, you know, we're still better than most states. We're still in a better financial situation than many states across the country. But to the mass budget and policy center, Noah Berger and his team, we got to have a serious conversation about taxes in Massachusetts to match our priorities and our values.
We have
and
to
we're
have
not
a
doing
serious
that.
Conversation about spending is what we have to do.
Well, I mean, there's about to be one because they're going to have to cut another few hundred million dollars from the budget because tax revenues, other than last month, were not where they intend to be. But, Michael, I'm not clear. Do you think this hurts Baker if it doesn't get fixed?
I
know we're a year out.
We've always been in threat of being downgraded. So I think
it hasn't happened in a long time.
But I think the reality is most people won't pay attention. I think the candidates who are running against him will lift this up. But it won't connect for the average voter. They don't know what downgraded means. They do know what it means when we can't pay our debt and when we have issues with making sure agencies are properly funded to do the work that they do. The rating of the bond rating will not matter to them.
Jennifer, when your fellow Republicans talk about spending in Massachusetts, I mean, I think it's becoming a total embarrassment how bad the tea is. I'm obsessed with the fact that you can run faster than the Green Line and complete the circle down Harvard. It's so terrible. And this does eventually hurt Boston because,
you know, a lot of kids, young people coming out of college, there's a lot of opportunities, don't have cars, they want to be able to get around. So how about spending on the T? If he's been pretty good about pointing out things that are wrong with the MBTA and, you know, money lost in the cash room, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You think that would be something that the GOP would go for, spending money to fix the T?
I don't know. I think as with everything, spending more money doesn't always solve the problem, right? It has to be accompanied with real reforms and changes in the organization. So, you know, I think I agree with you that that is a bread and butter issue for voters in Massachusetts, and quality of life issues are going to have a big impact on the gubernatorial race. But I'm not sure necessarily spending without change is an answer.
Well, yeah, by the way, they are making change. And I think Charlie Baker would say that. And by the way, they're spending some. He spent $87 million on winterization kind of thing. But it's still a mess. It seems to me.
He didn't need it last winter.
That's right. Of course. He was lucky. Well, the state was lucky. But, you know, it seems to me, staying on this for one second, if you were to ask me what are the two challenges that Charlie Baker has said I own, one is Department of Children and Families, and the reality is it's almost impossible to judge success or failure because you're always going to have a horrible outcome here or there, no matter how much you care about it. But I'm with Marjorie and I think Jennifer. The T is ultimately the something that affects virtually everybody, which he has said is mine. I wanted the financial control. I don't know if it's called the financial control board. I got it. I wanted relief from the anti-privatization laws in a limited fashion. I got it. Mm-hmm. This is a thing that could be an up or downer on Charlie Baker, depending upon what next winter is like, how people feel about the tea. No,
I think it could be. I mean, I go back to a relationship I've always had with a former chief, Beverly Scott, and the conversation she had before she left Massachusetts.
It's not my first rodeo, you know. One of the great lines from the last couple of years.
She was very much emphatic with me that this was about investment. It's about making sure our trains run on time and that they're properly maintenance, and you have to spend the dollars to do that, and it's been underinvested for many, many years. And whether it's the traditional T system or the commuter rail system, we have to make those investments. If we do not, we pay for it. We as riders pay for it.
And by the way, Jennifer, on your thing, virtually every person who studied the T, from David D'Alessandro, formerly head of Hancock, to these others, almost all of them say what you said. There's got to be reform. But I think virtually everyone who's ever done an analysis says what Marjorie says, which is there's got to be new money in addition to reform.
Oh, I agree. It's just her question was simply,
will people
do you think
spend?
Republicans would support more spending?
And we just found out that one of the big problems with the T, of course, one of the reasons they're broke is because there are more people that are retired from it than are working for it.
Big challenge, the T pension.
Well, it is a big pension challenge, and it's way underfunded. And as you know, until just a few years ago, Deval Patrick used to be able to work for them for 20 years, and that was it. Drives me crazy. I'm obsessed
jealous
with state
Marjorie
pension. I am jealous. I'm absolutely jealous. People
talking to Michael Curry and Jennifer Braceras.
So pretty fiery, passionate hearing up in Beacon Hill last week over whether the state should become a sanctuary state. Governor Baker says he's opposed to it. He doesn't want this to happen. Although his reasoning, at least in this Boston Herald story, was kind of strange. He said that would prevent the state police from detaining individuals for federal authorities who've been convicted of crimes like rape and murder, which I don't think is true. But anyway, what do you think about this sanctuary state bill, Michael Curry?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, this is one of the areas I think the governor could take a hit on, because I think that there is a general consensus that we want to be a sanctuary place here in the Commonwealth. Now, what that looks like, and I think the nuance of figuring out what the language should look like, that I leave that to legislators. But I think you have to be careful if you're a candidate for governor, and in his case, the governor who's running for reelection, to take opposition to it. I think he should be embracing the fact that we want to be a place where folks feel protected.
Well, state and local cops, well, not state because I haven't talked to state cops, but certainly local cops like Bill Evans, who's the commissioner in Boston, and other mayors think that being a sanctuary city is not really impeding the horrible immigrants that are doing terrible things. The illegal immigrants are doing horrible things, just the ones that are doing nothing but coming here illegally.
Look, this is a political football. I think Baker has been really clear that it's fine with him for local jurisdictions to handle it as they best see fit. He's sort of taken a federalist approach to it, which is also a way of not touching the issue and letting other people suffer the political consequences for either being for or against sanctuary status. That said, you know, I'm a firm believer that we're all part of one country, and state and local jurisdictions have to follow federal law. I mean, we fought this battle. We fought it at Appomattox. We fought it in Brown versus Board. I'm not kidding. I mean, you know, if we had town clerks in local jurisdictions saying, you know what, I don't agree with gay marriage, I'm not going to issue that.
We had one in Kentucky.
We did. And you know what? The vast weight of public opinion was against that person, even though a lot of people may not have agreed with the Supreme Court decision. There's a notion in this country that, you know, federal law is supreme. Fancy that.
Okay, Jennifer Becerra, fancy that.
Good to see you
Jennifer's
both, Jennifer.
Jennifer's conservative political analyst. Michael Curry is an attorney, the immediate past president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and currently on the national NAACP board of directors. Michael and Jennifer, thank you very much. Coming up, the counterintelligence investigation into Russia's interference in our election has to be mutated into a political scandal about President Trump. Are we overlooking the fact that Russia remains a persistent global threat to democracy? WGBH's news analyst Charlie Sennett joins for that and more. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Michael.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Prentice. She's Marjorie. Last June, a majority of British voters defied expectations by voting in favor of Brexit. Last week, by confounding expectations again, did they vote for Trexit? Will Prime Minister Theresa May have to step down now that a snap election, I love that expression, has backfired with the Conservative Party losing its parliamentary majority? Joining us in Studio 3 for his take on this and what it means and other international headlines is Charlie Sennett. Charlie's a news analyst here at GBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Hello there, Charlie.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
So hello, Charlie Sennett. So as Jim just said, I mean, our expectations, I guess, have been wrong yet again because populism and the right wing was supposedly sweeping Europe and didn't happen in France. And
I think it's unpredictability is what we would call the rule of the day.
Yeah.
And don't you wish we had snap elections?
We're actually going to – that's our question for listeners at 12:30. Tell us what you think.
It'd be fantastic. Also, I like this idea of no confidence vote, that once in a while you can just intervene and say, hey,
this is two snap elections in a row. This is the Cameron election on Brexit and this one.
Well,
Two great rolls of the dice. David Cameron, just to go back, was the one who said, okay, if you really want to pull out of Brexit, I will hold a snap election, a referendum on this, and it will determine whether or not I stay as prime minister. Remember, he didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. It surprisingly won. The UK voted to pull out of the EU, known as Brexit. And that snap election, that referendum, led to his resignation the following day, which ushers forth Theresa May, really stable former economy minister. She's former home minister as well. She's smart. She's stable. You've heard me predict to you guys, I thought she'd be a really good steward to get this Brexit thing through.
Two weeks ago, they're predicting a landslide for her and the Conservatives.
I was completely wrong. The voters in the UK have now decided in their latest snap election, which she held because she thought, hey, I got so much confidence behind me, and I'm really going to need the support of the people to pull this Brexit off and to negotiate this well with the EU. And then a stunner. Suddenly she loses her majority in Parliament. Everything's up for grabs, and she's now trying to assemble some form of an alliance that will allow her to hold on to power. And it is like she's hanging in there by a thread.
Right. With some tiny little party in Northern Ireland? Is that what it is?
Yeah, the Unionist Party. So Unionist Party, just to remind everybody, if you ever followed Northern Ireland, they are the Protestant sort of old line guard there that is very conservative. David Trimble embodied that party for a long time. They would come in and provide her a very razor-thin majority coalition government inside the parliament, but it would leave her really vulnerable. It would also mean potentially some real changes inside the power-sharing agreement in Northern Ireland. There are a lot of things that could come from this rather, I don't know, perilous alignment that she's made with the DUP.
So, Charlie Stone, I'm just wondering, his snap election, is that something that we've heard about for decades, or is this a new term that we just have now?
No, it's, it's been around forever. Remember, the conservatives in the UK have a tradition of throwing overboard their leaders. They even did it to Maggie Thatcher.
This is what they do.
Yeah, when her popularity downturned, the conservatives have always been quick to jettison their leader and restart over again and try to go forward. And this is the fear right now, is that Theresa May could actually get, even though she builds a coalition government, she could still be replaced by her party with a new leader.
So is this seen, because we're going to talk about this a little bit later with listeners, is this seen as a good thing historically for Great Britain, these snap elections?
I don't know enough about it to know whether you'd have like sort of a historical analysis that would favor it or speak against it. I'd have to really look more carefully at that. What I do think is interesting is the core element of the politics of the United Kingdom that I love is resiliency. They do things dramatically, like vote for Brexit out of the blue. But then they'll stay, we're going to steer the ship by shifting this way so that we then can go in like more carefully. And the other thing is to watch the youth vote in the UK was somewhat dormant in the Brexit vote. And many people say that's how it won.
Yeah.
This time they plowed forward and they voted in big numbers for Labour, the traditional left party, and Jeremy Corbyn's party. And he's always been seen as this like buffoon who's never going to get elected, right? He's so far left. He's like a clown. He
could end up being prime minister.
Exactly. This is like Bernie Sanders suddenly coming surging back and coming right into the mainstream, possibly as a prime minister.
By the way, Charlie is not describing Bernie Sanders as a clown.
No, don't start sending emails
complaining. You know,
what they share in common is the unlikely perspective of an unapologetic far left.
Okay.
That's what they share. Not that that's clownish. Mm-hmm. In Corbyn's case, I think many critics say it is. I think with Bernie, we wouldn't say that. But they do share that core, which is unabashed, unforgiving, far-left politics.
And by the way, the guy had a pretty good day on Thursday, I should say, Jeremy Corbyn. Yep. So when they say she's the former cabinet minister who can't stand her, who's a conservative, called her a dead woman walking, that meant because the conservatives may replace her. That was your point a minute ago.
The other line was fatally wounded, which the Daily Telegraph, the sort of conservative mainstream newspaper, said, fatally wounded. That's not good.
So I have a bunch of questions about this.
I hope I can answer them. That's complicated politics over there, Jim.
Theoretically, the issue in this election was a so-called hard Brexit, meaning a hard sort of clean break with the European Union, favored by Theresa May. That's why she wanted a stronger majority, so that her hand would be strengthened in negotiations. And Corbyn is not anti-getting out at this stage because the people theoretically spoke, but rather a soft Brexit, which does what? What is a softer version? What does it mean to not have the clean break that May ran on in this snap election, Marjorie, and apparently didn't do so well about?
The hard Brexit was to say to the European Union, we are out, and we are out on our terms. The soft Brexit would be the EU is going to say, hey, you're out, and now we're going to dictate the terms of this. And I think it's going to be basically leaning more toward what the EU wants to shape as this divorce agreement. And it tilts now into the favor of the EU and how they want to shape it, as opposed to the hard fight that Theresa May felt she was going to be able to carry out and win. That is all now softened, and that will come down to very fine areas of trade agreements and very fine areas of security arrangements and other aspects of the agreement. But I think in its preponderance, what it'll mean is they're a lot closer to the EU, and they're going to slow walk the thing. They're not going to rush.
And why did things change so quickly? Assuming the polls were not totally wrong, literally 2 weeks ago, a landslide was projected for the Conservatives, huge victory for Theresa May, and obviously it didn't happen last Thursday. What changed in the intervening 2 weeks?
I think we live in times of great uncertainty on both sides of the pond. I think politically right now there is so much
impatience. Can't believe you said the pond, by the way.
with the status quo. Sorry, that's
we're
going to
bar Charlie
line.
For 3 weeks. So after over that one,
yeah, we're great. Well, we're great sailors here,
okay.
Right, Charlie?
I can't say the pun. It's like
I
an
can't,
old
it gives me hives.
One.
I'm right. Sorry. Go ahead. You said it.
I love it.
We'll forgive
so,
it this
so,
one.
So all right. So the idea is that uncertainty rules right now. I think there's just such dissatisfaction with the status quo that it's going all over the map. And I think the thing to watch for is youth vote. Youth vote's really, really important. And they came, they were not out in full force. And then Brexit happened. They came out in full force and they're expressing themselves. And remember, there is a part of this that Trump has openly aligned himself with May.
Right.
Trump is wildly unpopular in the United Kingdom. When he made those comments about the mayor of London, that did not go down well in the UK. And he was really,
right
really
seen.
Right
after the terror attack of a week
right.
or
Remember,
ago.
Instead of being there in support of our great ally, the United Kingdom, he came out and trashing the
Called
mayor.
Called him pathetic in
yeah.
a follow-up.
And apparently he's now rethinking his visit to the United
Keeping
Kingdom.
Trump, yeah.
Exactly. So I think all this is part of the what's at play in this very surprising and stunning
You know what
election.
You mentioned coming in, if I can mention it again on the air, that Corbyn, the Labour Party guy, has a close relationship with Putin.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what,
well, I don't
I mean,
know about a close relationship with Putin, but okay. a close relationship with Russia.
So were there stories about Theresa May involved in 38 murders and buying guillotines in the British press,
no.
like there were about Hillary Clinton
no.
here in the United
no.
States?
No, but I think it's curious. I haven't seen a word on this in the British media. I might have missed it, and maybe some callers out there know about it, and they can let us know, but I have not seen anything that would suggest any way in which Russia would want Corbyn enough
okay.
that they might play some of these dirty tricks they've been playing with politics in France and apparently are trying to play in Germany with the elections coming up
yeah.
there very soon. And definitely, as we now know from the testimony of Comey, played here in the United States. And I think, you know, I think we can keep going on the British elections, but I do think there's a really important undercurrent in all of this that's really the global view of Comey's testimony, which is we can't lose sight of the fact that what's really at play is a very dramatic attempt to undercut democracy
yeah.
in the Western world by Russia and Putin's men. That's the big picture. Comey was so dramatic in his warning about that. He really came. I thought that was like one of the most chilling moments of the hearing was that he's saying, hey, they are coming after us and they won't stop anytime soon. So I think that big canvas, that lay of the land is something not to forget as we continue to plunge into the political scandal as it unfolds in the United States. Remember, Democrats, Republicans, left, right, blue, red, it doesn't matter. If we have Russia coming after us to undercut our democracy, we should all care about that.
So, Charlie Senna, can we cross the pond one more time? For So, explain. I asked you to explain why the voters' preference changed so quickly in the snap election over there. Why did Donald
Didn't you
Trump?
Get it? I was trying to get away from that, Jim, because I don't know the answer.
Why did Donald Trump go from essentially not embracing the infamous, I shouldn't say infamous, but the now celebrated Article 5, mm-hmm. which is the mutual defense provision in
yep.
this NATO agreement, to we come back and Kellyanne Conway or somebody said, oh, he's totally behind it. And then the president himself, and we're all scoffing at that, the president said the other day in response to a question, this is from a Romanian reporter when he had a joint press conference with the president of Romania, well, I'm committing the United States and have committed, but I'm committing the United States to Article 5. Yes, absolutely, I'd be committed to Article 5. What happened?
Are you asking me to explain why Trump's all over the
yes,
map?
Yes, that's exactly.
Okay.
No, I'm serious.
I mean,
you can't be more unequivocal than he is
I'm
here,
afraid.
And you can't be more equivocal than he was 2 weeks ago
look,
in Europe.
One of the really chilling things about his speech at Brussels to NATO last month was he had his prepared remarks. Here he was doing
oh, that's
so
right.
well.
You're right.
And he himself omitted the sentence on supporting Article 5.
Yeah.
The core element that ties us together militarily to support each other. And who has long wanted that? Russia.
Russians.
The Russians have been pushing for the U.S. to back out of Article 5 forever. The fact that Trump chose to delete that one sentence from his prepared remarks, which had been approved by his Secretary of State and presumably his staff and everyone else, was really interesting. That he's now backtracking and recognizing that maybe that wasn't so smart is also interesting. Can I explain it, Jim? No.
Okay. We like honesty on this show, Charlie Center. We're talking to Charlie Center from the Ground Truth Project.
But the same thing has happened with, and I always, I'm not sure if it's Qatar or Qatar.
So. I say Qatar. What do you say?
Qatar.
Qatar.
Qatar. Okay. Fine. Thank you very much. You settled it. The same thing happened with his remarks about the blockade of Qatar. He said, the president said one thing, and then Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, said something else. So this is, this seems to be a pattern of the president being reversing course, or maybe at the urging of his cabinet.
But it's within an hour. No, but it's within hours. For those who don't know, Tillerson basically took the position that this bloc of Arab nations should ease the blockade of Qatar. And I think was it an hour later? It was the same day, I believe. The president prescribed a hard line on this. And so you say, on one hand, that's a good cop, bad cop kind of thing, if it's conscious. Or you say it's just Donald Trump going rogue whenever he's in the mood.
I think it's the latter. I think it's the latter. I think the messaging from this administration, particularly on the Middle East, is perplexing and confusing, in part because the president doesn't know the issues of the region. You know, I said, I want to remind everybody, I said the same thing frequently about President Obama, that he did not hear the Middle East's music. He was not good in the Middle East. Remember we talked about him like sort of fits and starts and balking. And it's very hard to understand the complexity of the Middle East. And it's why you surround yourself.
Where, like in places like Egypt, you mean?
Right now the region is on the edge of a conflagration that could really quite literally become a world war. You have the Sunni-Shia divide playing out in the war in Syria. You have Russia and Iran aligned with the Shia. And then you have Saudi and the United States aligned with the Sunni. And you have things happening like Turkey coming in and saying it will support Qatar in this new sort of blockade that could actually hurt their economy. You have the great game, to use a phrase from the 19th century that was going on in Afghanistan. The great game is now playing out in the Middle East, which means the world's powers are vying for control of the Middle East in a very perilous game that can involve a conflagration of conflict, which in the case of the late 19th century became World War I. I don't want to be overly like paranoid or say something that could make people feel like we're on the edge of some world war. God forbid, and I hope that's not the case. But the combustible elements right now in the Middle East are worrisome, and they're more worrisome because of the fact that we seem to have a president of the United States who, A, doesn't understand the landscape politically, and B, is not listening carefully to advisors like Rex Tillerson, love him or hate him, who really do know the region.
Yeah. Well, you know, Stephen Kinsner, your former colleague at the Boston Globe, had a very scary piece in the Globe yesterday talking about Saudi Arabia and they're fostering all this terrorism. And they are very, you know, they have that
Wahhabi
super conservative form of Islam over there that's so repressive. And it made me wonder, then why were we just so nice to them?
why are Tillerson and Trump doing sword dances with
the
guys who?
Because it was a very, very bleak, dark picture of Saudi Arabia.
Stephen Kinzer is on the money almost all the time. And I think he's really on that one. Because if you remember, everyone knows this, but just to remind you, 12 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia. I have traveled on the highway that leads up into the Asir province of Saudi Arabia, right on the border of Yemen, which is where Osama bin Laden's family is from. That highway that leads up there is the Wahhabi heartland. It's like driving through the Bible Belt of America, except you are in the heart of Wahhabi ideology and fundamentalism. And I literally was going rogue as a reporter for the Boston Globe right after 9/11, looking in at schools and stopping and almost getting arrested at every step. And we caught a tiny glimpse of how radical the theology inside Saudi Arabia is on that road from which 12 of the 19 hijackers were recruited. We don't see that enough. We don't get in there enough. They don't let reporters there enough. Saudi Arabia is at the core a theocracy that really the whole royal family is empowered by an agreement with theocrats that keep them in power. And those are Wahhabi fundamentalists that espouse a very, very violent version of Islam.
You know, we only have a minute left, but since you mentioned Afghanistan, 3 more U.S. service members killed there. Barack Obama declared an end to the war, 3 years ago? We still have almost 10,000 people there.
And counting.
After a war is over, Donald Trump is talking about sending 3,000 to 5,000 more. And the worst part of this, Marjorie and I were talking about this over the weekend, the fact that this pathetic Congress does not care enough to debate these issues, to vote for an authorization or against an authorization for funding or force. It is unbelievable.
It really
the
is.
Longest war, as you've brilliantly done in your Forever Stand thing, the longest war in American history. And do they ever talk about it in Congress? Is there ever a debate about anything? And more of our people are dying. It is really unconscionable. And by the way, the only reason is because it's a voluntary army. So as a result, it's not our kids. And so for the vast majority of them and us, we don't give a damn, which is really unconscionable.
You know, I live out in central Massachusetts, right near Fort Devens, where every day if I'm with my kids on the soccer field and I'm watching their games, if you listen carefully enough, right here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, in central Massachusetts, right near Ayr, you can hear young men training to go over and fight in Afghanistan every day if you choose to hear it. And I can't tell you how many times my neighbors and friends, we talk about that and we think about right here, right in our community, this war is still going on. America's longest war needs a lot more debate, and we've got to get at it.
Charlie Sennett, thank you very much.
See you, Charlie.
Charlie Sennett is a news analyst here at WGBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project.
By the way, as soon as you figure out what happened in that election, you give us a call.
I will. Next time I'm across the pond, I'll let you know.
Coming up, Michael Botticelli joins us. For nearly 20 years, he was with the state's Department of Public Health. From there, he went to D.C. to serve as President Obama's drug czar. Now he's back in Boston to run a drug addiction treatment center out of Boston Medical Center. Michael Botticelli joins us next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
At noon on today's Boston Public Radio, former Obama drug czar and now at Boston Medical Center, Michael Botticelli joins us, hell-bent on prevention and reducing the stigma of drug addiction.
Our TV man Bob Thompson on 2 noteworthy passings, Adam West, the original Batman, and the genius who gave us those wonderful acclamations, Wallace and Gromit. We'll open the lines and ask you, the Brits don't like who's running the show, the Brits have snap elections. With Trump's polling numbers plummeting, do you wish we could have a snap election too and change things now instead of in 2020? We're all revved up with Iron Monroe and Emmett Price on liberal evangelicals taking on conservative evangelicals in hopes of reshaping America's moral agenda. And then get this, people who are chronically late supposedly live longer and are more successful. That's according to a new study anyway. You buy it? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to hour number 2 of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
So what is it outside again, Marjorie?
Scorcha.
Thank you very much. That's right. So when it comes to being a successful writer, most of them swear by the old adage, write what you know. Is what's true for writing also true for public health professionals? In the case of Michael Botticelli, it certainly is. Recovering from addiction himself, Botticelli served as the White House's Director of National Drug Control Policy during the Obama administration. He knows firsthand what it means to be addicted and what it takes to get sober. It's an invaluable background for someone who's working to steer people who have addiction problems away from the criminal justice system and into treatment and support. Michael Botticelli has returned to Boston, where he spent his prior life, to run Boston Medical Center's new Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine, which aims to become a national leader in fighting opioid abuse. It's great to see you, Michael. Thanks for being here.
Great. It's good to be here.
So tell us, Jim just said you're running the new Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine. What does that mean? What are they trying to do over there?
So Boston Medical Center, you know, health Boston in general is just a great place to be as it relates to healthcare. And Boston Medical Center has a very, very long history of dealing with addiction issues, particularly for, you know, Medicaid population, really disenfranchised folks, and have really become national leaders in some of the models that they've developed and, you know, really wanted to, I think, accelerate the work. And particularly with the opioid addiction, we've come a long way, but we have a really long way to go. And through the incredible generosity of the Graykin family, who are from Massachusetts, they gave the largest gift in the history of Boston Medical Center.
$25 million.
$25 million.
Why'd they do that?
Well, I think one is, like many people, they've been personally touched by addiction, you know, as most families have. But the other piece, and, you know, they're usually anonymous about their donations, but they, like many people, I think, understood the stigma that often surrounds addiction, and they wanted to do it in a very public way to, one, call attention to this issue, and two, to really spur other philanthropy as it relates to addiction. You know, we've seen great philanthropy here in Massachusetts and the nation for a variety of health conditions. But, you know, unfortunately, not necessarily around addiction, just because, again, I think of the stigma that surrounds people who have this disease.
Well, I want to get to the stigma in just a second. But before we do, when you mentioned Boston Medical Center, I'm thinking right across the street from Boston Medical Center is Healthcare for the Homeless,
correct,
where Jim O'Connell has been a physician there for years. And he's got an idea that seems kind of radical to people about supervised shooting up, basically. Tell us about that and what you think of it.
So, you know, again, I think, you know, Massachusetts and Boston has been the model for this. And, you know, part of this, I think, as Boston, as Massachusetts, has thrown basically every tool in the toolbox at this issue, we still see an extraordinary amount of overdose deaths. I think you're aware that now we have these synthetic opiates called fentanyl, which really, I think, make it, they're so much more powerful than heroin that they make people overdose faster and make responding to overdoses with naloxone or other resuscitation really difficult. So these safe consumption sites that they're called are in Vancouver and other parts of the world. And the data, I think, are really compelling in terms of being able to reduce overdose deaths, reduce infectious disease like viral hepatitis. So I really think, you know, the challenge becomes that they are federal law still makes them and state law still makes them illegal. So I think there is these are really worthy programs to be investigating. Now, clearly, they have to be part of a comprehensive response in terms of what we're doing. But I really do think they're worth investigating.
You should talk to Marty Walsh. He's not quite there yet. We asked him about it on Friday. And, you know, speaking of the stigma issue, which I know is one of the things when I was reading the Globe story about your coming back to Boston and going to BMC, on your list was reducing the stigma. And a couple of things. One, I'm curious to know why you think it exists when it doesn't exist around so many other diseases. But secondly, it seems to me the best poster person for reducing the stigma is Marty Walsh. I mean, when he stood up at the Democratic National Convention, what was his first line? I'm an addict. And I'm assuming 99% of the people, when they heard next coming up is the mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh, they had no idea about his history. And Marjorie, and you were, when Marjorie was talking to Mayor Walsh on our show on Friday about a piece Scott Lehigh did in the Globe, saying, unlike his predecessor, Tom Menino, who had a bit of a temper, things, I don't know if it's fair to say, wash off Marty Walsh a little bit more easily. And Marjorie asked, is it because of what you've experienced in recovery? And he said, unequivocally, the answer is yes. I mean, he is exactly, well, part of what you need to get rid of that stigma, yes?
You know, exactly. And, you know, it's part of, you know, I can't ask for a better person to really champion recovery than elected officials, high-profile people, to be really open about their recovery. You know, part of what I try to champion at the federal level is really encouraging. You know, I'm one of, like, estimated 20 million people in America who are in recovery. I don't know a family, quite honestly, hasn't been touched by this issue. Yet we, you know, remain silent. And, you know, and I will
That makes the stigma even more less understandable in light of the fact, as you say, that everybody's been touched by it. Then one would assume that we'd all become sensitized to the reality, but we haven't been. There is still a stigma.
There is still a stigma because we haven't talked about it in an open, honest way. So when you have people like Mayor Walsh saying, you know, my name is Marty Walsh and I'm a recovering alcoholic at at the DNC.
That's what he said, right?
When you have other elected officials, when you have other people who are in recovery, I think it's really twofold. One, it really destigmatizes this. And you know, you begin to see, and, you know, this has happened with other diseases like cancer, like HIV and AIDS, where if you know someone, it really diminishes the stigma and, quite honestly, contributes to better public policy when we do it. So and I think that we're beginning to see a change. I'm eternally optimistic, but I think if there has been any sort of any modicum of good that's come out of this opiate epidemic is people realizing that we need to diminish the shame and stigma, and people need to be much more outspoken about their own journeys.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. This Associated Press style book, which decides how we're going to talk about things, has decided that they're not going to use words or try to avoid words like alcoholic, addict, user, and abuser unless they're in quotes or the names of the organization. And they're going to switch to phrases like "he was addicted," "people with heroin addiction," or "he used drugs." What do you think about that?
I was so grateful to see the AP style book come out with that. You know, one of the things that we did federally is actually put out a language guide to all of our excuse me, I have a bit of a cold.
It's okay.
Put out a language guide to all of our federal agencies about the use of clinically appropriate, non-stigmatizing language. When you call people an addict or a junkie or even an abuser, you know, when you say abuse, it sounds like people are doing it, you know, of their own accord, of their own volition. And it doesn't reflect that this is a disease. And, you know, as much as I think the media has done a great job around the opiate coverage, around the opiate addiction issue, I cringe when I hear some of the language that people use that people like me who struggle with this hear, and you internalize, and parents hear this. And so we really have to use clinically appropriate, non-stigmatizing language. And again, I go back, you know, think of some of the terms that we used to call people who had mental illness that
terrible.
We just don't use anymore. And it's really time that if we're going to diminish the stigma, changing our language really becomes a powerful voice in how we do that.
Speaking of language, again, when Walsh was with us on Friday and Marjorie or I referred to methadone mile, he said, "I prefer to call it recovery something or other." I mean, that's the same deal, right? Is it not?
It is, because, you know, again, one of the things that we've seen is that, you know, we have very highly effective medications for the treatment of people with an opiate use disorder, methadone being one of them. And you know, I remember years and years ago, this is how long I've been in Boston, there was a front page article on the Boston Herald that took a photograph of Big Dig workers who were in line for treatment. And the headline was "Big Dig Junkie." Right. And I can't think of a more stigmatizing, like, these were people who were in treatment who, like, we should be applauding and supporting. And, you know, this was a long, long time ago. I'm going back. But even methadone within treatment still is very, very highly stigmatized.
So is it okay to call you former drug czar? Is that not okay?
You know this. I hated the term drug czar.
So can you tell us a bit about you? I mean, I realize we know about you. We've spoken to you before. For those who don't know, Michael Botticelli, former drug czar, if you'll excuse, now at BMC. Tell us about your history and how you got into this.
Sure. So, you know, my story is very atypical. You know, I got into this field largely as a result of my own recovery. And I think, you know, one of the kind of really proud principles about recovery is this responsibility to give back kind of what you got. And, you know, many, many people in the recovery movement go on, both formally and informally, to continue to give back. And, you know, I was very fortunate to be able to work. I worked for many, many years at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. And for the last 9 of those years, I ran the Bureau of Substance Abuse Services in Massachusetts. And I think because of the work that we were doing here, particularly around the opioid epidemic, it kind of got noticed federally and was invited to join the Obama administration. And just, you know, it was really incredible experience, incredible responsibility, you know, but also a tremendous opportunity to really, I think, make progress as it related to the opiate epidemic. You know, this was a top priority for President Obama in the last few years of his administration. And I think we were able to do a tremendous amount of good and working in a bipartisan way with Congress to get some things done.
By the way, it was a top priority for candidate Trump, too. Do you remember the thrilling old days
yes.
of yesteryear when he was going to eradicate this problem, not just for kids, but for adults?
I do. But I think, I think that hasn't translated into any sort of action. And quite honestly, his support for many of the provisions that Congress is proposing about repealing the Affordable Care Act will, really wreak untold damage.
Particularly the Medicaid cuts
The Medicaid cuts. We know going in that the Medicaid and Medicaid expansion population had high prevalence of substance use disorders. And we saw some really great results in states like Kentucky and West Virginia and Ohio. The number of people who are able to get treatment because they had insurance coverage. And, when we look at data, only unfortunately a very small percentage of people who have an addiction get treatment. And one of the biggest obstacles that they cite is not having insurance coverage or not having insurance coverage that has an adequate substance use treatment benefit. And we were, just beginning, I think, to see some really good results coming in for people to get treatment. You shouldn't have to wait months or weeks to get treatment. You shouldn't have to. And I talk to parents all across this country who, had to second mortgage their house or deplete their savings account to get their kids. That should not be. You should be able to get treatment when you need it for as long as you need it. And that's what we were trying to work on federally.
We're talking to Michael Botticelli. He's executive director of the Boston Medical Center's new Center for Addiction Medicine, the Graykin Center. But, I wonder whether there's a possibility of changing that cutback in the opioid treatment, because, you read about a lot of the states that were heavy Trump voters are people that do have significant problems. If the politicians in those states might be able to put some pressure on the White House and do something.
Well, it seems like that they're I think we have a number of governors who have expressed their concerns in terms of what the changes are. Governor Kasich in Ohio, I think,
yes.
is a really good example.
Who took Medicaid expansion to cover an additional million people.
And he always talks about the impact on the opioid epidemic, particularly as it relates to access to treatment. So I think this is why it's really important that not just politicians, but people really make their voices heard about this, that parents make their voices heard, that people, that local politicians. I can't tell you how many law enforcement officers I've talked to who understand not only the public health implications of ratcheting back treatment, but also the public safety harm that we could reach. I like many people, have my own criminal history as it relates. So this won't just be damaging from a public health standpoint, but also a public safety standpoint. And many of our law enforcement officers get that.
One of the things I've been reading more and more, and I also have mentioned this to Jim, I did a story for The Globe about when we were voting on legalizing marijuana here and went to the medical facility that they had in Brookline. And I was surprised, and this is only anecdotal, but I've read since then that it's not so anecdotal. It's fairly common that a lot of people that were on opioids have it's better being the gateway drug we talked about, that it's like the scale back drug, that many people wrote there, and apparently around the country this is true, that there are people that have been able to get off of opioids by using medical marijuana, which they said, oddly enough, because you think of when you're high on marijuana, you're high. But they were saying they were able to think better on the marijuana than they were on the opioids. And these were chronic pain users. So what do you think about the move across the country to not just legalize, but to have more medical marijuana available?
So this was an issue that was particularly important to us federally. And, I will say that I think the federal government had a very long history of not only not encouraging, but putting up barriers to the legitimate investigation of the potential therapeutic value of marijuana, particularly in instances like this for pain. So, what we try to do is diminish some of the regulatory barriers that investigators have to go through. We actually doubled the marijuana that's grown for medical purposes. I believe that, you know, while that we still have a way to go in terms of the really clear scientific evidence around that. There's a lot we don't know. But I do think that part of what we have to do, and the federal government has a responsibility to do this, is to really investigate using all of the rigor that we do with other drugs to look at the potential therapeutic value of some of the components of marijuana. And I have to say, and folks might disagree with this, but I think we went a long way to really try to diminish some of the federal barriers that were in place around the use of marijuana for medical
purposes. But what happened to the Schedule I classification? My recollection was right before the end of the Obama administration, there were all these headlines that there was going to be a move to take it off the same schedule that has heroin on it, for example. And it came a cropper. What happened?
So one of the things that I think is really misunderstood about how drugs are scheduled is people think that they're a relative risk scale, right? So I often have heard, well, why is marijuana scheduled with heroin?
I'm one of the people, apparently, with a misunderstanding.
So it's not, it's not a hierarchy of risk. It's basically the criteria for where drugs are scheduled. And Schedule One is, one, you know, is there potential for harm? And second, are there known medical medicinal purposes for the drug, right? So it's not, you know, is marijuana more dangerous than heroin or less dangerous than heroin, therefore should be in a reduced schedule.
Or as dangerous,
Which
is how it's now classified, but you say I'm looking at it wrong.
You're looking at it. The
you can say that.
No,
it's okay.
I think, you know, I've heard this, and what I've tried to explain to folks is where drugs are scheduled is not relative risk. It's not a hierarchy. It's whether or not an individual drug meets certain criteria. Right. So it's a, you know, it's a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And so part of what, and there's a process that Health and Human Services goes through in terms of reviewing whether or not a drug should be moved or scheduled. Right. And again, you know, while I think that the government has tried to accelerate its work around medicinal purposes, you know, the FDA has not. There's other drugs that they've approved, but have not approved marijuana for those medical purposes.
The thing I never quite got is I understand if somebody believes it shouldn't be. I do. A decriminalization or legalization. How can a person who is still upright with a brain say that a doctor should be able to decide when he or she is sitting in a room with a patient that an opioid is what you need, but that same doctor should not be allowed to determine that marijuana is what you... Is there any argument on the merits, even if the science is not quite caught up? Is there any argument against that?
No, but I think the argument that the science, that we're not there yet with the science, really is where, at least federally, the position that we took. That, again, you know, I think we need to continue to focus on what is the scientific evidence to be able to do that. You know, I do think, and I'm not a physician, so I'll be open about that. But, you know, many physicians and many organizations have also said that probably smoking is not a good medical delivery device, right? You know, largely for respiratory function. And so you know, again, I am, very supportive of not arresting people for low-level possession. You know, I've talked about the fact that, you know, I was in favor of kind of decriminalization of this. But I do think that, public policy, you know, really needs to be rooted in good scientific evidence.
Well, the good news is the federal government's never going to spend any money on that scientific research, so we don't have to worry about that for the next generation or two. I mean, they're not, right?
No, but, and again, I think what we tried to do
I'm talking about now.
You're right. Things may change.
We're talking to Michael Botticelli.
We just talked last week, I think, with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, about how basically physicians started giving out these opioids with no scientific evidence.
On the representations
from the
of groups like what's the name
companies.
We discussed this last, OxyContin's, what's the name of the company?
I think it's Purdue Pharmacy.
Purdue Pharma, yeah. Right. I mean, you've seen those videos of those doctors in the white coats
perpetrating
a fraud.
The addiction of OxyContin was grossly underestimated.
There was a very interesting piece in the Journal of the American Medical Association last week that you probably saw, that much of the basis for the marketing of these medications as non-addictive came from a very small 100-word paragraph in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and that article was cited over 600 times, most of them incorrectly, as a rationalization that these drugs were not addictive. You know, and they used the full weight of their marketing practices to convince physicians that these drugs were not addictive, and unfortunately, it was combined with a very well-intended effort on the part of our medical community to do a better job of treating pain. So you really had this confluence of marketing practices of baseless scientific evidence around these being non-addictive drugs, as well as, you know, a real large-scale effort to do a better job of treating pain.
We're talking to Michael Botticelli. Michael, in a minute, we want to bring you back to Massachusetts, and now that you're at BMC, ask you, since Charlie Baker is on the Chris Christie-chaired Opioid Commission, what should Baker be doing with that seat? But before we leave there, getting back to Washington, when you came in the room, you mentioned we had a discussion about House of Cards and last time we spoke to you. But current events, it seems to me from afar, Washington politics is a real drinking culture. Is that?
I'm probably not the best judge of that.
I know that's
just
a very.
I didn't hang out in okay, a lot then. Of bars. Anecdotally, I don't think it's just Washington that's a heavy.
You don't think it's any worse than anywhere else?
I've always said that I think our country has an unhealthy love affair with drinking. When you look at binge drinking rates among particularly young adults, I'm someone who, like, moderation is not in my vocabulary. I don't see anything wrong with, you know, if you're not at risk, you know, of having a drink or two. So, I am not a prohibitionist, but I think that, you know, for many, many people, we are living in a culture where the cultural norm now is to drink to excess.
Yeah. Okay, let's come back here. What should Charlie Baker's, if he had a single mission, if you were to assign the single mission to Baker in his seat on the Trump-appointed Chris Christie-led Opioid Commission, that's not what it's called, but that's the gist of it, what would it be?
So first of all, you know, I don't think we need another commission to figure out what we need to do as it relates to the opioid epidemic. I think we've known for a very long time.
And what is that? Is that thing that we need to do?
I think we know that it needs to be comprehensive, multifaceted response. I think we need to make sure that we are reducing overprescribing of prescription pain medication.
Did we make strides on that front where the legislature and the governor did whatever they did six months ago or a year ago?
Is it a three-day limit or something?
Well, the first prescription has to be for only X number of days. Was that a step in the right direction?
So I haven't seen data specific to Massachusetts. I do know nationally, for the first time in decades, we actually saw over the past couple of years about a 12% reduction in opioid prescribing. I haven't seen data from Massachusetts to see what the impact of this new law might be. But we also need to make sure that people have adequate access to treatment and treatment on demand. We also need to make sure that anybody who's in a position to see an overdose has access to naloxone, the overdose reversal drug, around it. We need to make sure that people have access to sterile syringes so that we're not continuing to. We've seen huge increases in viral hepatitis with people who are injecting drugs. So we need to make sure people have adequate access.
And should the Gloucester experiment be emulated throughout this country?
So one of the things, I'm a Massachusetts boy, and one of the things that I'm really proud of is how law enforcement has leaned into this issue. We had naloxone.
Treatment versus prosecution.
We had naloxone distribution started by the Quincy Police Department. We saw, diversion to treatment started by the Gloucester Police Department. And we've seen those programs expanded dramatically and quickly across the country. And I think, honestly, our local law enforcement folks get the fact that you can't arrest and incarcerate people out of addiction. And those of us in the public health world, I think we're incredibly inspired and quite honestly astounded by the dramatic support that we got from law enforcement. So you see these partnerships between public health and law enforcement that I think, 10 years ago, nobody would ever imagine. And again, I hope, with the attorneys, attorney general's kind of new focus on, not here in Massachusetts, Maura Healey has been great on this issue. I mean, Attorney General Sessions moving back to tough on crime, that we're not going to see a retreat from state and local law enforcement on how they partnership with public health in terms of these really incredibly innovative models.
We're talking to Michael Botticelli. He used to run the White House's National Drug Control Policy during the Obama administration. Now he's back in Boston working at Boston Medical Center. You know, we started this conversation talking about Marty Walsh, and the joke was that Tom Menino, who didn't even drink, by the way, the previous mayor, had a bad tempered throat. The joke was you should throw the prosciutto on the floor if you
I just want to go on record that I didn't make any comments.
Marty Walsh has been in recovery, I think, for more than 20 years now, right? It was quite some time. I'm not really sure how long he's been in recovery. But in any case, he's been in recovery for quite some time and seems much more calm guy. You know, just in my own life, and I'm curious what you think about this, because this is, again, anecdotal, but people that I know that have had drinking problems that either went to AA, did the 12 steps, do the Serenity Prayer, are some of the best people I know, because the Serenity Prayer is a very beautiful prayer. Mm-hmm. And the 12 steps, like going out and making amends to all the people you shafted in your life. I mean, if you're not in recovery, most of us don't think about all the people we need to make amends to. It's really powerful stuff. And maybe we need this for people who aren't drug or alcohol problem users.
I think the 12 steps and the principles of 12-step programs apply to everybody.
Yeah.
It's really about a way of life and a way of living. You know, it's as they talk about in 12-step groups, it's only the first step that talks about drinking
right.
and alcohol. And the rest of the steps are really about how you live your life.
Yeah.
And how do you live your life as like a good kind of spiritually based member of society? I'll just speak from my own perspective. You know, it's been astounding for me, you know, to think about where I was and think about where I am now. And I'm not talking about jobs that I've had. I'm not talking about the material things in my life. I'm talking about what it means for me on the inside. That, you know, when you're in the throes of drinking or doing drugs, you're not the person that you ever set out to be. And recovery restores that on the inside. You know, the outside stuff is all gifts. It's all gravy. But it's really about what you get on the inside
yeah.
that matters. And I think people pick up on that. You know, Mayor Walsh and other folks, I've heard, like, my family members and friends, despite the fact that I'm still an antic Italian and, you know, kind of prone to talking loudly and getting upset, you know, just talk about kind of how much calmer I've been in recovery for over 28 years. And, you know, it's really remarkable. And that's why it's so important that people like Mayor Walsh and me and other people in recovery talk about it. We have to show people, particularly in this epidemic, that there's hope on the other side. And, you know, I will say as kind of one person, you know, when you're, you know, when you're using, I'll just say, like, I didn't see a life. I didn't say, how can I be happy without drinking? You know, how could I possibly have, you know, particularly in this culture sometimes. And it's so important that you see people in recovery and you see kind of who they are and who they become, because we have to give people hope on the other side of this issue. And, you know, and I think just, you know, demonstrating and being open about recovery just shows people that you can have this too. You know, as the expression goes, I'm just a bozo on the bus. You know, that I'm not unique. My story's not unique. Mayor Walsh's story is not unique. There are millions of people who've been kind of restored because of their ability to get treatment and have recovery. And, you know, Mayor Walsh talks about the fact, quite honestly, that, you know, he was in a union that provided treatment and support, you know, and I think it just underscores, you know, that people need access to treatment and recovery support if, you know, if we want to have, you know, healthy families and healthy communities.
No more bowling alone, as a guy from Harvard said. Bob no Putnam. It's
well,
great
good
to
luck.
See you, Michael.
Hope,
welcome back to town.
Yeah, and I hope things go very well in your new job. Michael Botticelli is the executive director of the Boston Medical Center's new Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine. Michael, thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it very much. Coming up, our TV expert Bob Thompson joins us for his take on where Comey's testimony ranks among other televised congressional hearings. He is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Before actors such as Ben Affleck, George Clooney, Michael Keaton, Don Batman's cape, here was Adam West, the original, whose mix of screwball and straight-faced portrayal turned the Cape Crusader into a pop culture hero.
Our job is finished. Let's go. But inconspicuously. Through the window.
Joining us to remember Adam West on what we truly do refer to as our control room bat phone is Bob Thompson. Bob's professor and founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hey there, Bob.
Hey, actually, my bat phone is out of order. I'm talking on my shoe phone today.
So tell us about the significance of him. I remember these early Batmans. He was terrific.
But, terrific.
Where does this fit into TV history, Bob?
Well, it was it didn't last long, but it was a big moment. I mean, you could get. I remember having Batman bubble bath and Batman toys and all of this kind of thing. And let's remember, Batman, of course, it started out as a comic book, and there had been some serialized movies, but this was a very early audiovisual iteration of Batman, long before the big high budget movies and all the rest of it. And what was interesting is it was done, of course, with elbow deeply in rib and tongue deeply in cheek. But if you were a kid, you didn't necessarily right. know that. I was about 7 or so when this came out, and my brother and I watched this show with no idea that it was a send-up. We thought it was a high adventure and action. And they did another interesting thing. It was on two nights on two separate nights. It was supposed to be an hour-long show, but instead they had two time slots available. So you saw the first half, and then there'd be a cliffhanger, and then you'd see the second half the night after. And that gave it an added bonus because, of course, stuff wasn't serialized in primetime back then. So that made it really exciting. Color had not been around for too long. 1964 is really the first season where color starts to really kick in. This is just a couple years later. And it was a reason to get a color TV. The colors on Batman were, of course, designed to look like a color page in a comic, and they were spectacular. And then, of course, there was the acting, which was just, in retrospect, so totally over the top. And Adam West had that voice that could so completely pull that off, and he played it in totally straight, as did everybody there, way ahead of its time as a deeply satirical, ironic, wise guy kind of program.
You know, you and Marjorie both mentioned how short a period of time was on. I didn't realize till I read his obituary. It was 2.5 years. Reminds me of my favorite situation comedy of all time is The Honeymooners with Jackie Gleason and Art Carney. What was that on? 39 episodes or something?
Single season.
Yeah.
Now, there were the Honeymooners sketches played throughout many years on Jackie Gleason's various variety shows.
So, yeah.
They existed, and those were the lost episodes that came out later. But as a standalone series, one single season, 39 episodes, the classic 39, as they're called.
So did Adam West, I don't mean to be disrespectful, as they say, did he ever do anything other than do Batman retrospective shows in the decade since?
Well, he had started out starring in a bunch of movies, a bunch of television shows, and he'd done a number of movies as well. And then, of course, later in his life, he became the voice of the mayor on Family Guy. I believe the mayor's name is Adam West, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
So he got introduced to a whole new generation of viewers, including my students, who were big fans and are big fans of Family Guy. But obviously his legacy, far and away, will always be Batman. And someone I would compare him to that went a very different direction would be Shatner, William Shatner, who mm-hmm. was on Star Trek right about the same time as Batman was on. Shatner also did that kind of ridiculous acting on the original Star Trek. But he went on, of course, to repackage himself, win a couple of Emmy Awards on that law show, that David Kelly Law Show, and really managed to reposition his career in a way that Adam West didn't. There is one great pilot called Lookwell, created by, get this, Conan O'Brien and Robert Smigel, so a great pedigree. NBC made it in 1991, and alas, it never went to series. But it was about Adam West playing a former star of a detective show, and after the detective show's been canceled, he's under the impression that he's still a detective, and he goes around trying to solve crimes, even though he's just an actor. It was a hilarious pilot. You can sometimes find it wandering around on the internet, but never became a series, and that could have been his second great masterpiece, but it didn't happen.
Was Smigel the guy behind Triumph the Comic Insult Dog? Is that the
right? Right, and
brilliant.
That TV play,
brilliant.
TV Funhouse, or I forget what it's called, but those little animated shorts. And the pilot was, and the pilot had a lot of Batman type of aesthetic in it, but
you know,
never went further than one episode.
Speaking of deaths, even though it's much lower profile, the guy who voiced Wallace and Wallace and Gromit, I have to say, one of my favorite, what is it, Claymation? One of my favorite
best
things ever. One of the funniest, cleverest things ever done. This guy in his 90s, Peter Salas, is that how you pronounce his name? Who was
right,
the voice
Peter
of
Salas, and he, of course, did Wallace and Gromit, the Claymation beloved
great.
By around the world, but become a real symbol of the UK. And he also was on Last of the Summer Wine, which went for 37 years, a comedy also from England. So he had a long career.
Here's a little bit of sound from Wallace and Gromit.
No cheese, Gromit. Not a bit in the house. That's it, cheese. We'll go somewhere where there's cheese.
By the way, for those who don't know, Gromit was a dog.
The dog. And this is the thing. This is one of those things.
By the way, graduated from Dogwarts University.
Yeah. That's right.
And you told me about this, Jim, when my kids were little. And I was so grateful because somehow I'd missed it. And it was one of those things where you could watch with your kids when they were like 4 and 5. And you would be falling on the floor. It was so, the kids would love it, and you would love it. It was so cleverly done. Remember the great scene where he came down?
Slid down the pole into his clothes.
Into his pants, which are waiting for him at the dining room table. It was absolutely
didn't he have a
hysterical.
Bed that would wake him up
yes.
by dumping him out of the bed?
Yes. Like
onto
that.
The pole, right. And then the toast then went into right his hand through. When he went. It was brilliant.
Oh, my God. And people haven't
the
seen
whole,
it.
It had that British, in many ways, it reminded me of Winnie the Pooh. You know, remember how Winnie the
yes.
Pooh, all he really, really always thought about was getting a smackerel of honey. and in Wallace's case, it was cheese. There was something just so charming about that.
Well, they always had these very poignant ones, too, where there would be some Gromit would get lost, or there was the evil dog that came
after. Well,
they
had a great relationship,
dog.
The two of them.
Yeah,
just...
I mean, or there was that woman that was always kind of lonely, that kind of liked Wallace. I mean, it's just, if you haven't seen it, it was wonderful.
And it does hold up, as we
it
talk about movies.
It does
absolutely
hold up.
It very much does.
So, Bob, what's the best of the week for Bob Thompson?
Orange is the New Black debuted its whole 13 episodes on June 9th, and it's in season 5, and oftentimes that's when series begin to show their age. And this is a very odd season. The whole thing, all 13 episodes, takes place within 13 days. The first six, or I'm sorry,
three
all
days.
13 episodes take place within 3 days.
Right.
So the whole season is 3 days, and the first six episodes or so are just 24 hours. And each episode plays out in real time, and it's the prisoners have overtaken the prison. And very, very interesting. Some weird things happen, but the payoff in the final episode of the fifth season is really nice and really satisfying. And that show, which was one of the two biggies that kind of launched Netflix along with House of Cards, is still, I think, filled with interesting and fascinating surprises.
And she's a local girl. We always forget to point that out. Taylor
Schilling,
she's from Massachusetts.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
well, so, you never forget to point that out.
Oh, I do? Okay. All right. Well, you know, we don't have that many huge big stars. You know what I mean? So it's great to point
out. Oh, yeah. There's no Affleck. There's
no Damon. Well, that's right. Who else?
Chris Cooper was nominated for a Tony Award last night, won an Academy Award.
Okay, Chris Cooper, that's not well,
see, Marianne Leone, by the way, was sitting next to him last night looking beautiful.
Okay, we got what was the one Tori just said? I didn't hear what she said.
One of the greatest television dramas of all time, one of the greatest TV shows of all time, and one of the greatest dramas and comedies were both set in Boston. St. Elsewhere and Cheers.
Fine
Very good point. Okay, let's play a little clip for the trailer for the Orange is the New Black's fifth season. Here it is.
If we want to turn this place right, we have to speak as one united group. Jose.
Are you insane?
No, she's angry. We're all angry. You done our girl wrong, Mr. Caputo.
And we want justice.
To whom it may concern, we the inmates of Litchfield are human beings. We are protesting the abusive conditions under which we are being held. We're going to give them a show.
You know, Taylor Schilling's from here. I don't know if you knew that. So, Bob, is there a humor in... I mean, prison riots are not exactly classic fodder for humor. Is there humor or is it a more serious season?
There is still, of course, last season ended with the death of a beloved character that sent shockwaves through the fan base of Orange is the New Black, and this whole prison riot and everything is picking up on that. And if you recall, Orange is the New Black in its first season was nominated for Best Comedy or Best Program in the Emmy Comedy category.
Mm-hmm.
So it does still have a lot of that. And in fact, that's always been one of the things that makes this show good and interesting and fun, is that it does really blast away this Aristotelian notion of not mixing comedy and tragedy. This season, however, it's almost a little weird. It is a very serious season. We're in the midst of a prison riot, and this time, and there's a lot of comedy in it, but it seems a little more shoehorned in than it has in previous seasons. All of a sudden, we'll be going through this high drama stuff, and then there'll be these almost slapstick kinds of things. So that's one of the things I think that may be a little weaker in this season.
Okay, Bob Thompson, what's your worst?
Well, everybody's been wondering what will happen to the television universe when Apple starts making original programming. And they did, and they just introduced it. And so far, at least, we don't have to worry about what how much competition they're going to bring, because it was really kind of an old-fashioned, not terribly original program, reality show called Planet of the Apps.
I love that
title,
name.
By the way, is the best thing.
Yeah, that's
about
clever.
It. It's a If you've seen Shark Tank, it's essentially Shark Tank with a little bit of The Voice thrown into it. And it's 10 episodes where people come in and they present their idea for an app, and then judges the likes of Gwyneth Paltrow decide whether to move them on to ultimately get a development deal and a position on the Apple apps menu. Yeah,
so since we'll never talk about it again, here's a clip from the trailer.
I should say, too, besides Gwyneth Paltrow, it's Will.i.am and Jessica Alba. It's a pretty impressive cast, I say.
Well, impressive in that Will.i.am, Jessica Alba, and Gwyneth Paltrow are all very talented in the arenas they work.
Yeah.
Whether they should be judging the quality of apps for phones is another story. And in a couple of cases in the first episode, one or the other decides not to vote for it by simply stating, "I don't know anything about this field."
Oh, okay.
Here's a clip from the trailer for Planet of the Apps.
Planet of the Apps is a television show that focuses on budding entrepreneurs in today's world.
Developers rise an escalator, 60 seconds, pitching their idea to the four advisors, and we swipe left or right.
Congrats.
Whoa, what the world?
I need this.
It's incredibly brave to have the idea to create something and to come present the app on a show, on television.
This is the app.
We're building a brand. It's all integrated.
I don't think I could do it.
You know, the trailer is always supposed to have the best of the episode. If that's the best, they're even in more trouble than you're suggesting, Bob.
You know, I'm thinking this is not a TV subject, but do you really think Apple, I mean, what has Apple done lately? It's just put out more phones.
They have.
It's kind of like Steve Jobs is gone.
And Tim Cook spoke at the MIT commencement, and he did. He was with James Corden singing the other day in his car. So that's what he's doing.
Okay, Bob Thompson. So tell us a little bit about your take on the Comey hearings.
Well, it was interesting how they were calling it, you know, the Super Bowl of the summer and all of this. And in fact, first CBS announced that they were going to play these live. I think we may have talked about that last week. Then ABC and NBC decided they were going to play them live. Of course, all three of the cable channels. So this was live all over the place. I think kind of like the final episode of Lost, people at the end of it found themselves not quite as compelled by it as they were expecting to. But for all of the big deal this was made of, as though it had never happened before, television and hearings have a long and storied history. Way back in the early days of television, the Army-McCarthy hearings, 188 hours on ABC and DuMont, who didn't have a lot of successful programming, so they figured might as well put these hearings on. And those became, you know, phrases became part of the American vernacular. Someone put on a song called Point of Order, I Love You, or something like that, making fun of McCarthy's constantly interrupting by saying Point of Order. Those were huge, and they were the final nail in the coffin of McCarthy's reputation. Of course, we had the Watergate hearings. Those went on for over 300 days. Oftentimes, the networks were alternating who was covering those. I think PBS covered them in their entirety. We had Iran-Contra. And, of course, the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings, which I think really maybe had more of an impact than any of those in raising consciousness about harassment in the office and all of that kind of thing.
Well, and all you can almost come up with the quote that will live forever for me, from high-tech lynching to what did the president know and when did he know it. And having, you know, I have to say, we broadcast it live on the radio, Bob, and we watched it on CNN as we were doing it. And while I had mixed feelings about how big of an impact it would be, when I was spent the weekend watching some of it over again, and you hear the head of the FBI calling the sitting president of the United States a liar, it is really unbelievable. And so that's going to live with us, I think, too. The former head
of the FBI. Were there big ratings?
Well, there were, and part of it was because everybody was airing.
Yeah, so you had no choice.
So
yeah.
There were people who obviously were deliberately going to that who normally wouldn't be watching morning television, but also the audience for all those networks who might have been wanting to watch The View or whatever else was out at that time were seeing it as well. And it did get a lot of – the entire news cycle the previous week was essentially one big promotional announcement for what this was going to be. It's true what you just said. If we would have taken a transcript of those hearings and put them back 4 years ago, nobody would ever have believed it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could say that about a lot of situations we're facing right now. So what should we be watching this week?
I'm going to be watching, it starts tonight, that it's over four nights, the Putin interviews, not Megyn Kelly this time, but none other than Oliver Stone. So I don't know what to expect with this. I'm very skeptical when celebrities decide to try to become journalists and interview people. Remember Sean Penn and El Chapo,
I do,
for example. And from what I've heard of this, at one point, I think in one of the first two episodes, either tonight or tomorrow night, Oliver Stone mentions Dr. Strangelove, apparently, and I haven't seen it yet, but apparently finds out that Putin has not seen Dr. Strangelove, at which point the two of them sit down, watch Dr. Strangelove, and then discuss.
Yeah, well, you know, Oliver Stone's reputation has sort of taken a hit in recent years. One of these pieces I read about this was talking about how, you know, he's embrace some kind of wacky ideas. I remember his JFK movie was kind of wacky.
Sure.
So
I'll give you an example. I saw, well, neither of you, I guess. I saw not a trailer, but a commercial for this on CNN last night. And he is fist bumping Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
I mean, really?
Yeah, that he's kind of really turned Vladimir Putin into a nice guy, which is not a good journalistic.
I mean, it appears like it's almost sycophantic. And again, exactly. I only know from the 60-second commercial. But having said that, I think it's a what to watch, too, frankly.
I think it might be a disturbing 4 hours. So it starts tonight and it goes through Thursday. But it should be interesting. This is Showtime, by the way.
Yeah.
So we can watch a repeat of last night's episode of Twin Peaks and then immediately follow it by the Putin Oliver Stone interview. The big question is, which is going to be weirder?
Hey, before you go away, I haven't gone back to Twin Peaks since watching, I think, almost an hour of the 2 hour premiere of the season. And I think you said give it a chance, which I haven't yet. Does it make it, or does it continue to disappoint people like me who love the original?
Well, as long as you just decide two things. One, that this isn't the original. You put the original into its own legacy and leave it at that. And then just go to this one as sort of an opportunity. Think of it as your 30th high school reunion if you really liked high school. You know, then you really want to see those people again, and you really want to have those old conversations, even though ultimately the people aren't as pretty, they're not as interesting, the conversations are no good, but the very fact that you're with them again. And that's how I actually am really enjoying Twin Peaks. It only sits on my DVR for a very short time before I watch it. It isn't the original. It isn't close. In some ways, it's a big fat mess. But it's really fun watching David Lynch do that thing that he did back in the beginning of the 1990s. So I still give it a thumbs up if I were Roger Ebert.
I love your high school reunion compare. That is perfect. I'm going to go back. Bob, good to talk to you as
always.
Thank
you very much, Bob Thompson.
Thanks, you guys.
Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Okay, up next, do you have Parliament envy? Would you prefer the instability of Parliament with the promise of change over our stable
Parliament
but locked
envy.
In system of government? Do you want a snap election too? We're asking you next. Want a snap, Jim? Want a snap?
I think I'm leaning in that direction.
Okay.
Yes, Margaret.
We're asking you next on 89.7 WGBH. Pro snap or not on Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. So for the first time ever, more voters are now in favor of impeaching Donald Trump than are opposed to impeaching the president, 48-41. That's according to a new public policy polling survey. Public policy polling survey.
Nicely done.
Thank you. Americans are also experiencing buyer's remorse when it comes to Donald Trump. Poll finds that by a margin of 49-41, people poll wish that Hillary Clinton were president instead. Add to that the president's approval ratings, bless you, Marjorie, which have been 54% disapproving. So with all this in mind, how envious were you of the UK's snap election last week? A chance for a do-over, an opportunity to hit that proverbial reset button. I can't believe Charlie sent it out of nowhere. He had no idea we were talking about this. Remember Charlie said a couple of an hour ago?
Snap.
God, wouldn't you love to have
snap
this?
Snap election.
So granted,
I just
the UK
want to talk about it.
What?
Snap election. I just
well,
like the
fine
sound of it.
I know you've said it enough already. So granted, the UK is currently in turmoil, but obviously so are we. And a look at the parliamentary system suggests it might make a lot more sense. So when you factor in how partisan and contentious things have been here in Congress for years, how gridlocked our democracy is, and why things don't get done, does a parliamentary system with the ability to have these snap elections make sense? We're asking you, 877-301-8970. We know it's not about the change, but we conceptually want to have the discussion with you. If our constitutional, whatever it's called, federal republic is overrated, should we go the way of other parliamentary democracies? And by the way, if you say I like this snap election thing, where you essentially can change the government midstream. The election's supposed to be, what, every 5 years in Great Britain? 2015 was the last regularly scheduled one. The next one was supposed to be 2020. As we said with Charlie Sennett, there have been two. David Cameron staked his prime ministership on a Brexit vote. He didn't get it. He resigned. He stepped down the next day. But to do this, you also, Marjorie, a little bit of pause for you, have to adopt the parliamentary system, which means you're putting the government totally in the hands of one party. Now, that's what we've chosen to do here, but we're not required. I mean, in this election, we gave everything to the Republicans. Sometimes it's we give everything to the Democrats. But there, the whole notion is if you can't come up with a parliamentary majority, you don't have a prime minister. When you do cobble together a majority, either only of your own party, like exists the conservative thing, but not as of the election does it exist anymore. They have to build a coalition. They elect your prime minister. So essentially, it's do your best, boys and girls. We'll be the opposition party. So you have to like that and accept that if you want to have the ability to essentially do a redo midstream, which is what's happened in the UK. I like stability a lot, but I love the notion that if the country is going dramatically in the wrong direction, and by the way, I hope even Trump supporters can step back and say, when you couldn't stand Barack Obama midway, would it have been healthy to have a vote? If people reaffirmed their support for his leadership, then the people have spoken. And if not, there could be what is going on now in Great Britain. So we want to know, which side are you on, the parliamentary side or the side that we have over here? 877-301-8970.
What? People who don't like Donald Trump should not embrace this too quickly, because this poll out of ABC News says that if we had the election all over again today, he'd still win.
Yeah, but when was that?
It was not that long ago. It was the end of April.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's the way it is today. But that's, you know, regardless, that's not even the issue. The issue is, I mean, it's the current issue, because obviously people line up on the pro and anti-Trump side. Beyond that, I like it. I really like it. You know what it's like? It's
sort
of why I support term limits for Supreme Court justices, because I don't want to be stuck for life. Well, if a president for 4 years does something particularly egregious or proves that he or she really can't do the job or is leading us in a really dangerous direction, then you have a chance for a redo. I like it a lot.
Really, I can't imagine it happening here. I just can't.
Well,
imagine.
It's not going to happen here. Obviously, we have to amend. We have to essentially toss out the Constitution. But
and I think it'd be too nerve-wracking.
Why?
Well, I don't know, because the election season is so overwhelming here. I mean, it's just.
You think Donald Trump? Excuse me. Do you think Donald Trump would
snap.
Be taking health insurance away from 24 million people if he knew there might be a snap election 6 months into his presidency or 4 months into his presidency? I don't think so.
Well, that's a very good point, Jim.
Thank you. I knew that would get you.
877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Although they'll just spin it and say he's not doing it. It's going to be great.
Well, I understand.
You're going to have the best health care ever. It's going to be great. It's going to be much better than Obamacare, which is a disaster and a death spiral. It's going to be terrific. Best health care ever. And, you know, like I said, some people believe him.
You know, one of the I don't know if you remember this. John Kerry, when he was running for president, and it seemed that if he were to be elected, he'd have a Democratic Congress.
Uh-huh.
His response, he was asked the question about, isn't a divided government good for America? And his response was almost a parliamentary response. I can't believe I actually remember this from so many years ago. He said something like, give my party a chance to control everything, see what we can do. And if you don't like it, throw us all out, which is essentially, I mean, that is what this parliamentary thing is.
Yeah, but I think it's not working in the United States because...
What's not working in the
United
States?
Well, I think we're so divided now that people can't agree on almost anything.
So what's your point?
My point is that if you had all... Look what's happened with Trump and Obama. Obama couldn't get anything through Congress, so he just did all these executive actions. Now Trump's come in, even though he can get things through Congress because he's got a Republican Congress, he's just undoing all of...
So where does that lead you? Where does that leave you?
Well, it leads you in the United States of America, where if you have all the Democrats in power, then the Democrats come in and do all these things, and then the Republicans come in and...
How can you say that Trump's can get things through Congress? He hasn't got anything through Congress.
he's undone a lot of Barack Obama's executive,
action,
orders,
yeah,
because Obama couldn't get anything through.
Oh, let's take some calls. Okay. So we want to know if you'd like the chaos of America or the chaos of the UK, I guess, is really what the question
you
is.
You know what I want?
What?
I just want to calm down.
You don't know.
Well, actually, it's funny you say that. Is the SNL thing. What was the line from SNL?
I want one day without a crisis.
Without a panicked news
alert.
Can I tell you one of the reasons why you might be happier in a parliamentary thing,
why too?
Why is that, Jim?
Part of the problem is when you watch Congress, particularly if you're unhappy with those in power, is everybody's polite. Will the honorable gentleman?
That's true.
Parliament has none of
they
that.
Scream.
I love that. Do you not like that? How do you like the prime minister? What is it, weekly or monthly? Weekly, I think, comes down to Parliament and members get to ask him or her questions. I mean, how much more direct democracy like is that?
Do we have tapes or do we not have tapes? We want an answer.
Dave and Dedham,
you're
first.
I'm going to let you out until you tell us.
You're on first on Boston Public Radio. What do you think?
Well, the snap election has to be called by the party in power, and so Theresa May screwed up.
She did.
Second of all, you know, this election is made, well, she also had that terrorist thing happen to him, and people don't want to talk about that, but that plays a big part of it. She was Home Secretary, which is essentially she ran the interior of that country for 8 years, and it's a mess, and they can't stop it. And, you know, she's cut police and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of people are pissed off about that.
But wait. But Paul, two weeks ago, she had a – I'm sorry, Dave. Dave, 2 weeks ago, her conservative party had a huge lead in the polls. And those – other than the terrorism, and I'm not belittling the importance of that, she was supposed to have a landslide. And by the way, David Cameron did a similar thing a year ago off Brexit, and he was surprised too. It cost him his job.
As far as the UK goes, they're even more polarized than we are. This last election wiped out the Liberal Democrats, which was the centrist party. They're essentially gone, and they got a couple people left. But they basically wiped them out. There's only the right, the far right, and the far left now. So, you know, there are downsides to these type of things, you know, parliamentary type of systems, where you get, and also you get a lot of fragmentation. You know, we would have different parties. We would have, you know, two or three or five parties if we had parliamentary type elections, which means we would never or very rarely have a majority government. As polarized as this country is now, imagine that. We'd have 10 parties.
Dave, thanks for a fine call. We appreciate it. 877-301-897. You know what appeals to me? I mean, he made a lot of good arguments against that system. I'm a believer in direct democracy, as you know. I mean, meaning in this state, that means ballot campaigns. I like people. I don't want everything to be decided by popular vote. I believe in representative democracy, too. But I feel we're sort of disenfranchised for, well, at least 2 years. But in terms of the presidential thing, every 4 years, maybe that's why I have some sympathy for this ability to call a snap. I didn't even know it was called a snap election last week. Did you?
I sort of want to get to the bottom of where did this come from?
What, the you mean
snap election?
What's the genesis of that term?
Yes, I love it. Yeah, it's a great term.
Okay,
I'm trying
to discuss the policy. You want to know where the term came from.
Skylar in the car. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Skylar.
Hi. My thoughts on this is just that a snap election would make our government too unstable for me. I think that it is a little ridiculous to have a president in, and as soon as they do something that some people don't like, have another election to make sure people are still backing them.
But wait, Skylar, the party of the prime minister, or if we had it here, the party of the president, the majority party, would be the one who calls the election. She herself, even though she may be the victim of it, she, Theresa May, called for the snap election. David Cameron, who was the victim of the earlier snap election last year, he was the one who called for it, both of whom wanted their hands strengthened. She, in terms of the negotiation of the Brexit, and him, in terms of the vote on the Brexit. So if you don't want the instability as a prime minister or a president, then you just don't call for the special election.
Well, that's true. That just kind of makes it a stupid move at that point.
Well, or a move if you had gotten what you wanted that strengthens your hand. I mean, for example, let me give you an example. Let's assume there's a debate, which unfortunately there probably won't be anytime soon, about our continued involvement in Afghanistan. And the President Trump says, before I send 5,000 more troops, which doesn't quite double the size of our force there, but
more.
It's like 60% more. I want to have a snap election to make sure the people of America are with me on our continued involvement, or the expansion of our involvement in America's longest war. that might be an interesting situation. He said, I want my hands strengthened when I do that. And in those circumstances, they could have a popular vote. So, I mean, by the way, I see your side of it. I understand the instability argument, but it has a lot of appeal to me. Skylar, thank you very much for the call.
The most exciting thing I've read in days, is the possibility that the Supreme Court may rule on gerrymandering, saying it's unconstitutional.
Yeah, is that really true?
Yes, it's a Wisconsin case. Wisconsin case where Scott Walker, remember he briefly ran for president.
Yep.
He's the governor there. Is he the governor there?
Yeah, he
still is the governor there.
Yeah, he is.
Anyway, that they gerrymandered their districts in Wisconsin to make it almost impossible for Democrats to win in significant numbers of districts. So the Supreme Court has ruled on this kind of stuff in terms of race stuff, but not in terms of...
So this case is about just the concept of these
tortured... Unconstitutional. District? Yes. Wow. I think that's very, very exciting. That could change everything, Jim.
But I understand what the basis... What's the basis?
Because your vote effectively does not count.
Oh.
If your district is...
So it's not one person, one vote kind of thing?
Exactly. That would put the Electoral College in some kind of jeopardy, I suppose, too. But the idea is that if politicians in your state... Massachusetts is obviously gerrymandering in the other direction so Democrats can win everything. But
do you remember Barney Frank's final district when it... Newton to Fall River.
That's what's so weird.
It wasn't his fault, by the way.
Because I live in Brookline now, and I have the same congressman as Fall River.
Joe Kennedy?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And needless to say, they're very, very different places and very different experiences of growing up and stuff like that. So it's odd. But the point is, I think that's very exciting because it would mean there'd have to be more compromise. There'd have to be more. It would be less hostile, the two parties, if you could just not get away with whatever you wanted to get away with. It would not have everybody so far to the right or so far to the left.
Right, exactly. That is the major consequence.
So that's very
exciting.
With
you. That is very exciting.
Okay. Paul from Worcester. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Paul.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I want to go back to something that you guys had a show on a while ago. It was more about a vote of no confidence. And I think that something like that would be good just to kind of tell the politicians, hey, look, you know, we hired you for this job and you're not doing it, or you're doing it. And let them know whether they're doing it or not. And then when come re-election time, maybe that'll be remembered as opposed to, you know, resting on some other laurel.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I mean, what you're basically saying is you want some vehicle, as I do, for the voters to express their opinion in real time on a major policy that affects us. That's where you are, right? And that's where I am. I don't know what the vehicle is for it, but that's where I am, too. And it's not enough, in my estimation, to vote every 4 years when you look at what's happening in Great Britain. Paul, thank you for your call. Appreciate it.
Let's go to Maureen in Bradford. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, Maureen.
Hi.
Hi.
I would love to see a snap election, but I know that'll never happen in this country. But that doesn't mean we can't change the way we vote without changing the Constitution.
Like what?
You know, for instance, ranked voting. Maine learned a very difficult lesson the second time LePage was elected. So they put ranked voting in. And people are always afraid to vote for a third-party candidate because they're afraid they're giving his vote to the opposite party. You know, they're throwing their vote away. If you can say, listen, I vote for Bernie Sanders, but if he doesn't get enough votes, I want my vote to go to Hillary Clinton.
Well, you know, Maureen, we have it in Cambridge, and without wasting your time right now, but I promise you another day we will. I ran for office loving the system. I actually won under the system, and I left hating the system because I'm not a huge fan, even though I know most progressives love ranked voting. Maureen, thank you for the call.
Did you say on your show the other night that you ate so much at the free buffets that when you quit the city council, you immediately lost 50 pounds?
I exaggerated. I tried to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing, but I didn't lose 50 pounds. I lost like 20 pounds. I mean, what happened, if you weren't watching Greater Boston the other night?
Yeah, they had unbelievable onion rings.
Monday nights when we had city council meetings, if you went into the city council chamber and you saw there was only one city councilor there.
Buffalo chicken wings.
The other eight of us were in the back room.
Blue cheese.
Eating free food and filling up our shopping bags with the free food to take home with us from the SNS deli, which catered our dinners. It really was.
It was unbelievable.
And I was an abuser.
I almost didn't recognize you.
Well, yeah, I know. It was amazing.
After 6 months of city
council. I was usually
going
to be carried home after a city council meeting. It was a tough night in the back room, the council chamber, as we call it. I think I was the only one who brought aluminum foil. I'll tell you the truth. I'm not sure, but there may have.
Scott in Boston. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Scott.
Hi. You guys have got, this is a real hobby horse of me. Of mine. I don't believe our system of government works at all. It might have worked back in the day, but this country is way too big and there's way too many factions to have an either or system. You know, it's either Republican or Democrat. That just doesn't work.
So what do we have? What should we have?
A parliamentary system would give you more voices at the table, seems to me.
Well, yeah, but why do you think, I mean, putting aside the sort of umbrella of the system, why have we been so incredibly resistant to third, fourth, and fifth parties in light of the fact that there is unbelievable level of contempt for, I mean, for example, we just lived through an election where both candidates were reviled by the American people. Sorry, you Hillary Clinton fans, you were almost as disliked as Donald Trump was by voters. That should have been the most fertile of field for a third party candidate. Is it only because there were crappy third party candidates, Jill Stein and what was the name of the governor from
Bill Weld was his running mate.
Johnson.
Johnson.
Gary Johnson, because they were such horrible candidates. How do you explain our lack of interest in a more diverse set of parties, Scott?
If you vote for a third party candidate, you're throwing your vote away. So if we had ranked voting, that would make
that's what that woman just said.
Much more likely that people would opt for a third or fourth or fifth party. We need more voices at the table than we're getting.
This ranked voting thing, we'll have a discussion in the next couple of weeks, I promise. I just threw out my opposition without explaining it, which I promise I will do. By the way, has anybody gotten to the bottom of whether Jill Stein spent all of the millions of dollars she raised to confirm the fairness and accuracy of the election? And if she didn't spend all the money, where the surplus went? Has anybody done a report on that?
I have not looked into it myself.
Okay, fine. Why don't you do that tonight?
Okay, Jim.
Get back to me tomorrow. Thank you.
Okay. Coming up, after 40 years, religious liberals opted out of politics. Now they want back in. The Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us for that and more up next. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3 for our version of Moral Mondays, our Reverend, which is particularly relevant today, actually, our Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist. Emmett is a professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Irene, Emmett, good to see you both.
Glad to be back.
And glad to be here. And happy Pride.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much.
Wait, you always bring us stuff.
Actually.
Where is it?
Well, normally what I've noticed is that you just discarded.
So that is so unkind.
I've learned we treasure what you bring us.
Really?
I thought I had learned because I used to do it also for the marathon. And I said, oh, you guys don't even look at the stuff.
Yes, we do.
I did. Jim threw it out immediately.
Oh, okay. There you have it.
Thank you for that, Marjorie.
Really, but anyway, happy Pride.
I'm only teasing. So I am so excited about this story about, it's not just about William J. Barber, the second or third, whatever he is, but because he came in here a couple of weeks ago and he started that Moral Monday thing.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
It was like 6 months ago, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he was.
It's actually last summer, right after the Democratic convention.
It was.
Yeah, there you go.
Impressive
that's
guy.
Exactly right.
And I see the front page of the New York Times yesterday, and there he is, front and center,
that's
the front
right.
page of the New York Times.
One, yeah.
So what is going on with this whole, less conservative evangelical saying, hey, you know, conservative evangelicals don't run the whole show here. What's going on?
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on. I think the children of those who were, you know, part of the evangelical movement back in the 60s and 70s have thrown their hands up and said, this stuff that we preach on Sundays, we're not living it out. So the compassion, the hospitality, the welcoming, you know, notions of health care, the notions of trying to eradicate poverty and the disparities in life, they don't see these younger evangelicals, their parents actually living and acting that out. And they see the younger evangelicals that the world that they live in seems to be worse than the world that their parents lived in. So they have thrown their hands up and they said, if you're not going to do anything about it, we will.
But, you know, it's also quite wonderful. And we were beginning to see this where progressive evangelicals were saying we're making a split. We began to see this chasm really develop, particularly with this what I call the Franklin Graham group and yes. then the Jim Wallace group. I'm using these two as two polar opposites yep. here. And Jim Wallace has come out with a book very much talking about that progressive evangelicals really must begin to take a stand here. I think the problem with evangelicals in general, progressive ones, they don't evangelize. That's number one. And number two is that the larger group of religious people and non-religious people feel that when you say you are evangelical, even religious, they think that you're having this battle between creationism versus evolution, that you're anti-science. And so what you're saying—
Or you're anti-gay right, or anti-women.
That's all of those progressive issues, and particularly anti-climate change,
yeah.
which particularly the sort of the what I call the Franklin Graham cohorts are definitely upholding this whole notion that it's a hoax. So we're seeing a great change. But I think what's also very good, it understands that in order to have the kind of beloved community that they want to have, it has to include not only Muslims, but people of no faith. And I think that William Barber, which I so greatly admire, he has left his position at the NAACP to do what King wanted to continue to do, which was a poor people's movement.
Well, if you're not a conservative—
By the way, his position has been taken by a local guy.
Who That's right, our guy. That's
Michael
right,
Curry.
Our
yes,
guy,
absolutely.
Yeah.
If you're not a social conservative, you know, anti-abortion, anti-gay, anti-women, whatever else— it's like the evangelical movement has become associated with that. That's what they're about.
Part of it.
It's not about poor people. It's about a lot. Well,
it's
not
about power.
It, but a lot
it's
of
about
it's
political
about,
so, power.
And they've sort of defined the moral agenda. And the same is true as Catholics. You know, Catholics have spent so much time worrying about abortion. And that's why Pope Francis was such a breath of fresh air, because he was talking about the poor, the poor, the poor, the poor, the poor.
Right.
So there's a schism in...
There's always been a schism within evangelicals. I think Irene has laid it out with the Jim Wallace and the Russell Moore and the Jerry Falwell and the...
Franklin Graham. Yeah.
And so that schism's always been there. But what's interesting now is that you do have this notion of the social gospel. And what does it mean to operate within the social gospel? And I think younger evangelicals who still subscribe to be evangelicals because they do believe in the power of evangelism and sharing
right.
the gospel, but are so they're not so much focused on what we're against, but they're about what we're for.
Yeah. And see, what happened is, particularly with young evangelicals, it was the question that folks were asking, particularly just talking about Trump's character. How do you uphold the biblical mandate in Matthew 25
yes.
that says that when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was a stranger, you brought me in.
Right.
And so what happens here is that this is a great move on many levels, because you do have young millennials. You have millennials who are not church, but are looking for a way to have their faith affirmed. And I think that by doing this, we will get some folks not only come back to the church, but we will develop a more progressive, as Emmett said, social justice theology and movement. This is such a great step, because I remember 2004 when Baby Bush was running, and you had the evangelicals running the agenda and using LGBTQ as a wedge
right,
issue,
right.
you know, and so much so that you had states were amending their constitution to define marriage between one man and one woman. And the problem that bothers me for someone who comes out of a progressive theological background like Union Theological Seminary and at Harvard, where were these progressive, well-known voices speaking up?
Well, where were they? I think that...
By the way, can I just interrupt and just to say as an update that a second federal appellate court has ruled that the travel ban, the revised travel ban by Donald Trump, is unconstitutional. So there are now two appellate court decisions. My apologies, Margaret.
No, I was just going to say that I think in some quarters, the black church seems to be different, because the black church, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a vibrancy that a lot of other churches haven't. I mean, the Catholics are dropping like flies. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Episcopalians, Presbyterians, dropping like flies. They are.
I love
I know.
Dramatically.
The Jerry Falwell evangelicalism gave religion a bad name in many quarters, because it was all about what we're against, it
yeah.
seemed to me.
Yeah, I mean, it was so about anti this, anti that, that many people were looking around trying to figure out what they were for. And the also notion is this kind of hypocrisy, right? So this notion of folks with money being mm-hmm. able to buy the lobby, the political lobby, particularly, you know, back when Irene was talking about in the Bush organizations or whatnot, that a lot of what would be progressive or liberal religious folks felt that they didn't need to participate in the national electorate, you know, and right. that they stayed on the local scene. So as long as in their neighborhood that things were reflected what they believed, they were okay.
They were good. They were yeah. they were insulated. But I need to just say this about the black church, though. While the black church of in terms of denominations across the country is still vibrant, it's not as vibrant as it used to be because millennials are not there. For instance, we have Black Lives Matter. And, you know, this is a movement that really pushed away not only from the black church but a theological kind of underpinning from it. So we're seeing it all. We're seeing it in all facets of life. But William Barber really is the linchpin that that can bring this all together. I mean, really do a kind of intersectional theological activism that is so needed.
And why is he the guy?
Well, he's the guy because he got a lesbian bishop, you know, part of his cohorts. He's got a Catholic. He's got Buddhists. He's got what Jesus talked about, the disenfranchised, the yeah. damned, and the disinherited. So he's the guy that can do it. And also, he's got the gravitas in terms of North Carolina fighting right. with the Moral Mondays.
Yeah.
Well, he's also one of the most inspirational speakers who ever lived. Oh, not yeah. that should be the sole criteria. Terry, you know, by the way, since you mentioned Black Lives Matter, I assume you both are good with the fact that the Journal of Political Philosophy decided to do an issue on Black Lives Matter, and they decided, I assume there just weren't enough. They didn't have any black scholars contribute any essays.
Yeah. All.
So, you know, it's more good news in addition to this, the rise of the voice, at least, of liberal evangelicalism or evangelism or what the word is there. Loving versus Virginia, which obviously was the case that decided that interracial marriage was ban on interracial marriage was unconstitutional. Margie and I just read a thing this morning that stunned me, maybe not you, that 1 in 6 new marriages mm-hmm. are interracial, which I am stunned the number's that high.
It's higher. It's actually higher. I need to say that.
You think it's higher?
Yeah, it is. It's really... I think that the problem with the poll is that they needed to look at interracial coupling.
What does that mean?
Well, what they're really saying is when they talk about interracial marriages,
straight?
They're talking about black. Well, that too, but they're talking about black white.
Right.
So that's the subtext. That's really because we've always had interracial marriages. The problem was that it was a violation in our state, in our country, if it was you know a black and white person.
There were the laws that existed at the time of Loving. Some prohibited whites from marrying Native Americans and the whole variety.
But the big one was...
But the reason I even bring it up, I'm even happier to hear the numbers even higher. We can... All the efforts we have to finally have the national discussion about race, which we've probably discussed with you 1,000 times and has been discussed 1,000,000 times, at some point the discussion becomes moot when 1 in 6 becomes 1 in 5, becomes 1 in 4, becomes 1 in 3... It does. I'm not saying we should wait, obviously, for this to happen. But those numbers, to me, are a really hopeful sign in terms of can't we all just get along? No?
They're hopeful if we can process them, right?
What does that mean?
So President Barack Hussein Obama, as I've said numerous mm-hmm. times here, it was the product of an interracial marriage or mm-hmm. relationship. Marriage, whatnot. But everyone saw him as black. And people fail to see him as a biracial person who could identify on both sides. And so we still force people to pick and choose which one. And so until we can get to the point where you don't force people to choose which one, then we can actually have a conversation.
But isn't that, again, I don't want to wait, but isn't that going to come by when interracial marriage is more the norm than the outlier?
It will, and I don't want to wait either. But if the divorce rate is still 50% and above, then it shows that there are some external tensions that are flailing some of the marriages.
And the other thing is that what is historically wrong when we talk about Mildred Loving in particular, we know that her husband
that was a good movie.
It was an excellent movie.
Yeah, I gotta see
and,
it.
And really, and a tragic life immediately following the Supreme Court decision, because what happened was that there was a car accident, and the car veered in the opposite direction that they were going, and her husband died immediately, and she lost her. eye. I met her because we
did
needed,
you?
Yeah, I had the pleasure of going to Milford, Virginia in 2007 because what we were doing, I was very much part of marriage equality and the national movement, uh-huh. as well as the one that's going here. And we needed Mildred Loving's endorsement to understand that this was the next wave of marriage equality. And so went down there in the middle of nowhere, Virginia, I need to say, because I mean, I just saw cow patches after cow patches. And to see this woman who really just wanted to be humble and just wanted to raise her kids with this man that she loved. But I wanted to say this about what Emmett was saying. In
Don't
terms
leave.
Of,
I want to hear about her.
Yeah,
too.
I will tell you more about her. Because the next year, you know, she died. And she died, at the age of 67. Isn't that interesting? In the year.
From what?
You know, health care down here is very, very bad and stuff. And the interesting thing is it was 1967 when it became a law. But my point is that the argument, and her grandson brought it up again, using Emmett's example, that we see things in black and white. Mildred was Native American, mm-hmm. and she argued that fiercely. The lawyers felt that it would be better for her to say that she was African American because people could get more on the bandwagon of that. But the thing also is that back in the day when you had the census come and look at people and stuff, anything that looked like me or Emmett or whatever, you automatically would say was African American.
Did she realize? I mean, I've read how, I haven't seen the movie, how humble she was. Did she realize how important
she
her
had
role
no idea.
In history
you know,
was?
I felt the movie did a wonderful
no,
idea.
I meant
yeah.
That, but when you spoke to her, did she realize how huge her place in history was?
Well, it was. I have a wonderful quote by her. But she absolutely, at that point, with people coming down here to visit her to understand, you know, do you know what you did? Do you know what you did? And she says this. She said, it meant to me to have the freedom to marry the person precious to me, even if others thought he was the wrong kind of person for me to marry. I believe all Americans, no matter their race, no matter their sex, no matter their sexual orientation, should have that same freedom to marry. I am proud that Richard, that was her husband, and my name are on the court case that can help reinforce the love, the commitment, and fairness. And she just goes on. And she says, that's what loving, the court case, and loving is all about. And it was just, it made us cry. We had a tape and we're boo-hooing, you know, and a very humble woman because we wanted to, like, give her money, like, we'll go shopping, put food. She didn't want anything. She said, thank you for coming to visit us. And she said, in her humble way, I am very happy, but I miss Richard every day he's been gone. You know, I lost it.
You know, but was that not, it was a unanimous decision, was it not? I think it was unanimous.
Yes, it was.
And you think about
was.
The different times.
Yeah.
My recollection is, do you remember the day Jeffrey Toobin called in? I don't know, about a year. I don't even know what we were talking about a couple of years ago. We discussed the Loving case, and I can't remember why either. And one of the things we talked about was, all polling at the time, the vast majority of Americans, plus those living in that state, were opposed to interracial marriage. So it was yet another situation where a court of grown-ups unanimously decided to lead the way, and the American people followed, you know, in those particularly around civil rights issues.
But the stories did talk about how, you know, it's also where you live, you know, that you can be in certain areas and it's fine, and other areas where
you can be
nasty
in Cambridge.
Looks and...
But I mean, I do feel like you go out into certain parts of even Massachusetts. But I want to say this about interracial love here. One of the problems is that for a lot of folks, it forces them to, it's not that they don't love the people they're with, but to not marry outside their race. So a classic example is Martin Luther King. He fell in love with a white woman while he was in seminary. And Daddy King said, no, this is not happening, and you leading a movement. Barack Obama, David Garrow has this huge, ridiculous, huge tome, 1,000 pages, that's come out on Obama. But, you know, the truth is Obama saw himself as an international kind of person. He never dated a black woman until Michelle. And the point was is that he understood, rightly or wrongly, that he had to create what was perceived within American context, an authentic African-American, you know, narrative. And she couldn't be looking like Beyonce. She had to look like me or Michelle. Do you know what
I mean? I remember when I saw him down at the convention. Remember we were there at the convention when he spoke? And I don't know who the hell this guy was.
This is
we're
talking about the convention here
for
John Kerry.
That's right.
And he gives a speech, and I was so wowed.
I kept
thinking, I hope he's got a black wife. I hope he's got a black wife.
Oh, really?
Yes, because I thought he had such talent.
We're not ready for the conversation, Jim.
Well, this is the beautiful, candid Marjorie Egan.
I did, because I thought he would be much more successful as a candidate with a black wife.
So we're scripted. See, we're and
true.
I find that script, that kind of scription or scripting similar to like like two women can't be together. You know what I mean? There's a kind of, you know, bias there.
Okay, so when you two leave and you're out in the hole, you and Emmett. I know you love Marjorie. What are you going to say about Marjorie, the comments she just made? Tell the truth.
Nothing. Actually, when we leave here.
You're talking about me?
No, because I'm usually talking about, listen, I got my Fitbit on. I'm going to Fresh Pond. Emmett is going to get some food or whatever. I mean, we're really like rushing out of here.
So when it's done, it's done.
Oh, it's done. Really, oh, it's done. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sometimes we argue about what he has said. But
usually.
But by the time we get to the car, it's all said and done.
Okay, do we have time for this?
No, we don't.
We don't have time.
Okay, oh, not about the Pope?
No, we don't have time for the Pope.
Are you going to say something good about him?
Yes, no. I
oh,
really
goodness.
Was.
Well, then
say
do it in 30
fast.
Seconds
say
so we can record
who,
it.
Okay, who will rid me of this meddlesome Pope?
Oh, jeez. Sorry, gave you 20
he
seconds.
He has no business okay. in that business.
Nice to see you.
Thank you very much,
Irene,
you guys.
You too.
Reverend Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us every week for All Revved Up. Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist. Emmett Price is professor of worship, church, and culture and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Up next. A new study finds that people who are chronically late are actually more optimistic and live longer. We're asking you, where are you on the punctuality spectrum? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brode. She's Marjorie. And we all have that one person in our life who's always late. If you think that person is stressed out about not being on time, you would probably be wrong. The stress is most likely on you. There's this new study. People who are chronically late aren't lazy. Rather, they apparently are overly optimistic about how much time they have. And this optimism not only extends their lifespans, but makes them more predisposed to be successful. We're opening up the lines asking who you are. 877-301-8970. Are you the person who always shows up early for something? Is that a symptom of being, I don't know, worrywart? Or assuming the worst that will always happen? In other words, are you stressed by it? Or are you someone who's chronically late because you think it'll only take, and that's part of the thesis in this study, it'll only take 5 minutes to walk from, say, I don't know, Central Square to Harvard Square when it's more like 15 minutes. Does the study ring true for you? What do you want to debunk at 877-301-8970? Unfortunately, you undercut the study because you are both often late and stressed. So being late doesn't cause you to be. Their theory is that stressed people are just, I mean, late people are just really optimistic. They're not stressed. They're just thinking that you're stressed.
Being late.
You are.
Yes. And actually, it's something I've learned from you, Jim Brody, because
what's
you
that?
Are always early.
I am.
You're Mr. Punctuality.
I am.
That just leave early and bring something to do it when you get there early, like your reading or whatever you've got to do.
I'm not early for social events. I don't want to be the first person or anything, but in meetings
you
and
sit in the parking
things,
lot.
I'll often sit in the parking lot.
Yeah, you
lot,
sit in
right.
the parking lot and you bring your reading with you, and it makes me much less anxious than tearing across town like a bat out of hell trying to get someplace.
But this is the exact opposite. Is it what the study concludes,
right.
by
the
way?
Reason, but the reason the reason they give for people being late is so true. You always, well, it's two things for me anyway. It's one, always underestimating the amount of time it's going to take me to do something. And second of all, waiting to the last minute all the time.
Yeah, but do the first thing, underestimating the amount of time they conclude is a sign of optimism, not a
right.
sign, a lack of.
Yeah.
Well, it is
house,
a lack of reality.
Dog, walk, do this with the
but
kids,
it's a lack of reality yeah. built on optimism.
Right.
And they say if you're optimistic,
right.
you're more likely to be successful and you're more likely to live a long life. So let's forget the reasons in your case. The assumption is since you're late for almost everything, you're here when the show starts most days. But, I mean, you are, in fact, almost every day. I mean, so you'll probably live a long and someday you'll have a successful life, right? Is that...
Some people might think it's a little bit bizarre that you're here like 7 hours before the show starts, Jim.
But, I, you know, that's a whole other conversation. But you know what it is? I mean, I do fit the pattern because I'm here, and because it is a stress producing thing. To have to get to everything early is stress producing, and I think that I do it to avoid stress by being late. You understand what I'm saying? That if I come early, I'm not going to be stressed.
Right.
But I come early, and then I am stressed because I'm so early. I know I'm not helping with this at all. Forget what my experience or Marjorie's. The whole notion is if you're late, you are overly optimistic about how much time you have and how long it'll take you to do things, which theoretically means that you are going to live longer and have a wildly successful existence. I hope I said that right.
Here's a classic.
What's
that? Lee just emailed this, and this is so true. She's the kind of person, and Lee, so am I, who will text, quote, "I'm on my way," when in fact I'm not even done getting ready to leave. I do that all the time. You'll say, "When are you going to be here?"
Great.
And I say 10 minutes, and actually I'm a good half
hour
away.
Are you lying because you're embarrassed or because you actually think you'll be there in 10 minutes?
I'm lying because I don't want you to give me grief about it.
Okay, let's leave Marjorie out of this conversation. Let's just have it. We'll just, and me too. Let's just talk to you. Bernadette, you're in Fall River. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for giving us a buzz. Hi.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had two quick points. One is I'm wondering if it's cultural because I'm Irish and Irish people tend to be late for everything.
Is that true?
Is that true? I knew we had big heads. I didn't know we were late for everything.
We're late. Marjorie, we're late for this.
Okay, go ahead.
It's really, really important. The second thing is it can create a lot of stress in relationships if you're the person that's always lackadaisical and your husband is in the military and he's the complete opposite. So
that's a great point.
Well, that's a very good point.
That's a great point.
That's a lot of stress.
Yeah, Bernadette, thank you for the call. It's a great point. You know, you mentioned George W. Bush. He was not in the military, but he was very punctual.
Last week I mentioned
that he had his meeting started at 9 o'clock and you better be there. The door's going to close. Bill Clinton was
cabinet meetings, not just minor meetings.
Bill Clinton late for everything. Barack Obama late for everything. I don't know whether Donald Trump is on time or not. I don't know.
I can't speak to the Clinton thing. Let's talk about Barack Obama. Does he not perfectly fit this study, saying he is late for everything, seems to be as unstressed as that? You and I will never forget my whole life, which is only tangentially related to this. Do you remember that the night that he had ordered the hit on bin Laden, he is not only at the White House press correspondents dinner, not knowing what the outcome is going to be and smiling and laughing, but whoever was the comedian that year is making bin Laden jokes.
Yeah.
And
Seth Meyer, was it Seth Meyer?
I don't know who it was. But whoever it was, there was a guy who, would you not agree, his stress level was quite low, and he was late for almost everything, people say. So maybe that's a good example of a correlation. In any case, let's go to Jessica. You're in a car. Hi.
Hi. Hi again. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
Hey, I call it Law and Order SUV also. Anyway, I'm very happy you're having this conversation because I know several of my family members and friends are listening, and I think they would probably all agree that I'm a pretty cheerful person, and I have one little thing is that I do feel guilty about being late, and mostly because I just don't want people to feel I'm being disrespectful of them.
Right, right, exactly.
But I do the same thing. I'll text. Or, like, when I get in the car to go, I'll pretend I'm a little bit further than I am, and then suddenly I hit traffic, or something like that. But I also have heard of studies that say that people who are chronically late are also of higher intelligence.
That's
and
right.
More creative.
Absolutely.
Oh, so, by the way, I don't know about the intelligence. I feel really bad. I forgot in the study when I was introducing it, it says exactly the second point that people who are late are generally more creative people. That's exactly what it says. So, Jessica, is part of the reason why you're late is because you have that optimism that's described in this study?
Yes. Well, I think it's more like I'm tricking myself into thinking that I can actually be there on time. You know, I can definitely be there by 8. I have a friend who once met me out for dinner, and once I got there, he had written up the Jessica time to real time conversion chart.
That's pretty good.
My friend at the bar.
That is great. Hey, Jessica, that's great call. We have a rotten connection, though, so we got to let you go. Thank you much for doing it. Do it again soon.
Robert says people who are always late should be drawn and quartered.
Well, I have to say, as someone who is almost always on time or early, it is aggravating. I mean, but that's not the topic for today. It is aggravating. I mean, you are you. I mean, you're disorganized. It's not like you. You are not disrespectful at all. In fact, you're the opposite.
You don't want to seem like you're being late on purpose. That is rude and obnoxious. Sam and Worcester, what do you think, Sam?
Hey, Sam.
Hey, guys. First time calling in. It's awesome to actually get on the line.
Well, thank you, Sam.
So for me, I mean, the study is whatever. You know, you're either late or you're early. I don't really buy the study thing. But for me, I grew up with a single mom and, you know, a dad who was late for every single thing. So I think for me, I kind of grew up, you know, I faced reality kind of early on. And so when someone's really late to something that I'm holding, I don't take it personally. But for me, I just get so stressed if I'm not on time. It's like I become that person, and I'm just so worried about being late. And Jim, I would love to know how you feel about this sort of I don't know if you'd call it an assumption, but this theory that, you know, if you're on time, you're not as smart. Like that kind of hurts, you know.
Well, by the way, that's not in the study. That was just that Jessica saying that. But let me tell you, Sam, I have the you and I are on the same path. Single mother, father who is always late, and I had that too. And I am exactly where you are. If I am about to be late for something, my stress level is absolute. It doesn't matter how insignificant the thing may be, because there's somebody else who's depending upon me being on time. My stress level is absolutely through the roof, which is why I choose to go out of my way to be early, even if it's sometimes inconvenient. Sam, excellent first call. Do another one soon, please.
But you know what's an interesting thing? If what? Your mother was always late or your father was always late, how that impacts you as a kid. You know, if you grew up with someone that was always late, do you go in the opposite direction or do you follow? Because my mother was always late and I'm always late.
What was that about in her case?
Well,
you're
I don't
just
know.
Disorganized. You, as I said before, a lot of people who are late are totally disrespectful in my estimation. You are like the least disrespectful person
on
the planet.
Thank you. That's very
no, I mean,
nice
you
to
are.
Say,
you treat people much nicer than they deserve. I mean, you do.
Or compared to you.
Well, as compared to exactly. That is pretty much what I meant. Our number is 877-301-8897. If you just tune in, there's this study that says that chronically late people, most of us think they're stressed like I am when I'm late, that I'm the outlier. Most of them are overly optimistic about how much time they have, and they are totally unstressed, or at least comparatively speaking, I shouldn't say totally. And their optimism not only extends their lifespans, according to the research, but makes them more predisposed to being successful. I understand that optimism can lead to success.
You know what's really upsetting?
No.
If you say, come over for dinner anytime after 6:30, and people show up at 6:30.
Yeah, it's really
they should.
Good.
They should at least give you 10 minutes, don't you
they
think?
Should. Yeah, sure, they should.
Adrian from Worcester, what do you think, Adrian?
I don't know what that has to do with anything.
It has to do with you don't want people to be too punctual.
Oh, you don't.
Hi, Adrian. I'm sorry.
I want you to say don't be too punctual. I mean, the doors open at 6:30, but don't show up at 6:30.
You need that extra 10 minutes of grace time. Wouldn't you agree, Adrian?
Oh, absolutely. Hosting is totally different.
Absolutely.
Hi, what's up?
So my older sister, my brother are polar opposites, and so it's really interesting because she is always so late that we tell her to show up for family events 2 hours early, and she's still an hour late. And we all, last Thanksgiving, we all took bets on how late she was going to be, which I kind of felt bad about, but everybody was pretty good-natured about it. So,
oh my
by the way,
God.
Are you exaggerating, or is that really true? You really tell her to
absolutely.
Be there early?
We couldn't, we took bets, and then people were like, no way, and we timed it, and it was true.
So don't go away. Does she fit the description we're giving of people who are late? They're just optimistic. They think they can get there faster than
you know
they
what?
Can.
I don't even mind, because she's such a wise and smart and caring person, and her
nice.
Sense of humor makes you feel alive. I mean, whatever. I'm glad to have her in her life, and I know she'll show up eventually.
Good for you, Adrian. You're great. That was great. Thank you so much for sharing the little family experience there. We appreciate it.
Tom says, my thinking of some being late all the time is that they think they are more important than others. So I am very surprised that Jim is punctual.
And by the way, you are not a self-important. You are not. I do have the slight self-importance problem from time to time. Marjorie has none of it. You have none of it. Your ego is so totally in check. It is painful.
Well, again, compared to you.
Well, compared to yes, that is. I guess everything comes down to that.
Yeah, it does.
It
does. Pat in Boston. Hi, Pat.
Hello, Pat.
Hi. I'm just wondering if the study looks at women, because I'm the queen of time denier, and I think bringing up four children and saying yes to everyone, you keep expanding time to say yes, and what I optimistically do is deny traffic. So I think it would only take me 3 minutes to get there, and it's 30. And I do what Marjorie does. I tell my husband, oh, I'm already in the car. I'm at the gas tank.
Well, you raised three kids, are you close to
Pat? You know what's been a revolutionary thing for me is that Waze traffic app, because it will tell you the time according to the traffic to get someplace, and it's pretty good, Pat. So if you put it in your phone at home and you say what time you got to get there, it will say if you want to get there by 6:30, you better leave at 5:45, or depending on the traffic. It's been a real
Do you lie to the app too,
game
or
changer.
Not?
No, I don't lie to the app. But it's interesting because you can see where if you wait longer, a half hour longer, or leave a half hour earlier, how it will impact the traffic. So it's kind of neat.
Pat, thanks for the call. Marjorie in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. You're on with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Hi.
Hi. Hi, it's Marjorie. Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes, hi.
Yeah, great. Hi. So I'm chronically late, and I do all of the things that you're talking about. You know, say I'm on my way when I'm not. I forget to take into account, quote-unquote, forget traffic. But I'm a psychologist, so I have a kind of tendency to self-analyze. So I have two ideas about being late. Oh, I also want to say I do not think I'm more important than other people. Okay?
Jim, I do not think I'm more important than other people, says Marjorie the psychologist. Right. Go ahead.
And I just want to say I think there's two things. One is that I'm a productivity addict. So I really want to get a lot of stuff done. And I do underestimate the amount of time it's going to take for me to do it. Two is another idea that's a little bit more psychological in nature, and that is that some people have separation anxiety. It's hard for them to stop doing or being with someone and move on to the next thing. So
makes sense to me. Hey, Marjorie, by the way, that's another thing I left out from the study, not only the creative thing that Jessica asked about a minute ago, but it also says late people are generally multitaskers like you. Hey, Marjorie, before you go away, though, what do you say to or read into a patient, who a client or whatever you call them, who is chronically late to see you? What do you say to them or about them?
I always try to address it. If it becomes a pattern, I say, hey, I've noticed that it's hard for you to get here on time. What's that about? Let's talk about it. Because I think it's different for different people. I think it's kind of past to say, oh, hey, it's because we're more optimistic and we're not stressed. Holy cow, I think it's different for different people.
Well, you know, when I used to go to shrink, I used to get there an hour early in the hope I'd get extra time. But that's a whole different kind of thing. Marjorie, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. We appreciate it.
So Jack says, if I told him to show up for dinner anytime after 6:30, he would arrive at the house at 6:15, wait in the car until 6:30, and then ring the doorbell.
Well, that's why I don't do the 6:30 thing, but I get to places, like you said, and you sit in the parking lot, you bring things to read, or you listen to music, or you listen to something, and then you go do the thing. But I'm totally with you. What's that guy's name, Charlie?
That's Jack.
Jack.
That's Jack, the guy that keeps track of all the things you're banning.
Oh, hi, Jack. Nice to talk to you. But you were totally right. This is a topic for another day. If you're invited somewhere at 6:30, you do not get there at 6:30. You don't get there at 8, but you don't get there at 6:30.
I think 6:40. 6:42,
I'd say. 6:42.
Okay, 6:43.
Exactly. Okay, fine. That's it.
Okay. We are done for today. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we are going to be at the Boston Public Library. Oops, where do I have my last page there? And what are we going on tomorrow? Okay, Jeff Corwin, the environmentalist, explorer, and TV host, is going to be with us to talk about what pulling out of the Paris Agreement means for wildlife. He is great. MIT economist Jonathan Gruber is going to talk to us about healthcare, and WGBH's Jared Bowen will review the latest in arts and cultural events. I want to thank the crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Molly Boygong, Christina Bieni, and our engineer is John the Claw Parker. What is on television? Jim Browdy.
Do you remember we used to work at another radio station, WTKK?
I do. Yep.
Do you remember a guy by the name of Michael Graham, his conservative talk show host? I am Michael Graham. Yeah. Well, guess who's on my show tonight?
Michael Graham.
Guess who's on with him?
I am.
Exactly. It's a reunion of our former radio colleagues. Me, Marjorie, and Michael Graham talking politics. Mike Ross's father is a Holocaust survivor. He and Roger Lyons have made this brilliant film, Mike Have, about his father, Steve Ross. You got to see it. And in light of our conversation a few minutes ago, I'm going to talk about what happened in Afghanistan a few days ago and how our Congress has got to wake up.
I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and keep cool.